Just for the court's information, we did file just recently, within the last few minutes, a notice of intent to seek the death penalty.
The Charlie Kirk assassination suspect, 22-year-old Tyler Robinson from Washington County, Utah, was arrested on September 11th after a 33-hour manhunt, following a confession to his father and a roommate. And what should have been a cut-and-dry tragic day in American history, but has only opened up a range of questions due to a lack of solid information and the sloppy handling of the investigation by the FBI. Why does the wink-wink, nod-nod Masonic number 33 keep coming up during press conferences?
In less than 36 hours, 33 to be precise.
Is it incompetence or a cover-up? A mixture of both? Or just another manufactured distraction to keep America's eye off of the ball?
Chair would ask that all members present in the chamber and those in the gallery please rise for a moment of prayer for Charlie Kirk. And the house will be in order.
Where are the pictures of the supposed engraved furry trans bullets showing motive?
And then they come out with a letter that is like ChatGPT. What are the 10 things people don't believe about this crime? And then they end up saying, ChatGPT, write me a letter saying every single one of these things and tie up every loose end, including the, my lover, my transgender lover. Don't forget my little furry. And don't forget the, remember when I engraved the bullets? Every single detail that people were finding hard to believe was wrapped up in this note, which there's literally zero Zoomer talk. There's no shorthand. Everything is completely laid out, beginning to end, as a total confession. Look under my keyboard where my note is. Every single part of it that they then will go into court and now read this into evidence. And people say, well, how did that happen? Well, let's go to the note. This explains how he got off the roof, where he went down, he changed his clothes, he left it here, he went into the woods, he ground the thing. I mean, every single question you would ever have is now part of evidence. And now this transgender whack job, who's obviously going to be state's evidence, is going to be there to corroborate it all. It's just completely unbelievable to me.
We don't know if it's him or not.
And why has George Zinn, the first man detained, admitted to aiding Robinson's escape, shouting provocations to create chaos for which he is now facing charges?
And then I think it was, what, a 9-12 or something like that, that second plane hit that tower. Immediately chaos. And we just said, oh, you know, that's got to be something. That's terrorist attack or something like that.
And I was in very, very close proximity. So I was clear at the east end, and I heard this loud boom. I heard this loud bang. And I thought, this is a gunshot, and there's going to be more of them. I thought it could turn into a mass shooting. So I go to the people closest to me. Everyone's ducking down behind the concrete retaining walls, and some of them were still kind of oblivious, but there were two people that were standing there. Two girls, very goth, very black, you know. And then I just walked, I stepped up to the side of them, and I said, did that not happen right here? Did you hear that? Was that right here? And they said, yeah, it was just right over there. So they're confirming, yeah, the shooter or wherever that sound came from is right here. The thing that didn't really dawn on me is that they were not running. They were not frightened. In fact, as I stepped up, I heard one of the girls, and they were talking to each other, and they're looking at these kids, looking at the scene down below them of all these people fleeing for their lives. And she says, go F yourselves.
And you're saying you're talking to him, and he gets in a car, he's got help.
The thing that was interesting to me was the people who were clearly very engaged in what was happening, unafraid of being shot themselves while other people are fleeing for their lives, and they have obvious contempt.
And where is the 30-06 round from a Mauser-type bolt-action hunting rifle that is believed to have hit Charlie Kirk?
I am a Marine, scout sniper. I did that for 5 years. I taught ballistics classes. I know it should be fair to assume that the FBI lies to us. I think everybody can agree on that. Let's not take them at their word on anything moving forward, specifically who the shooter is, where the shooter is, and anything from that angle. I would even go as far to say the round or the caliber of the round that the shooter was using.
We hit some new lows over the weekend with the MAGA gang desperately trying to characterize this kid who murdered Charlie Kirk as anything other than one of them and doing everything they can to score political points from it.
And why has there, led by unemployed morons like Jimmy Kimmel, been a sustained nationwide Mockingbird media gaslighting campaign regarding Robinson's sexual preferences and true motives?
It was very touching in a way that I think many of us didn't expect.
Welcome, ladies and gentlemen, to the War Room. I'm your host, Harrison Smith, coming to you live this Thursday afternoon.
from Austin, Texas. We're here at the InfoWars headquarters. And actually, we'll be I'll be jetting out of here probably at the end of this segment, probably not too much, or certainly not too much longer after that. Laura Logan is going to be taking over and hosting today's edition of The War Room. She's got some incredible guests coming up, so you're going to want to stay tuned for that. But of course, we're scrambling here. Everything's happening in real time here at InfoWars, and we're trying to field a full team here as things are constantly switching around. And what happened was after Owen left, we contacted some people, see if they wanted to host War Room. Well, we found a host that ended up being me, so I'm the permanent War Room host from now on. But we'd asked Laura Logan about a week ago if she wanted to come on and host, and she said yes. So I'm happy to hand over the show to her, since she always does such an incredible job. So stay tuned for that, and make sure, please, do support us at thealexjonesstore.com. Thealexjonesstore.com is where you want to go to get the merchandise, the incredible supplements, become a VIP member. By the way, we don't say this enough. When you become the VIP member, you get access to an exclusive archive of every show Alex has ever done, going all the way back to like the early 2000s. And it's the only place on the internet that you can find these shows. It's the only available archive out there. You cannot find it anywhere else. But if you become a VIP member, you get exclusive access at thealexjonesstore.com. So please do support us, because after all, the big story today is the firing of Jimmy Kimmel. Oh dear, we're all so very sad that this despicable, inhuman, heartless scumbag no longer has a platform to demonize good people, demonize normal people. And I just was going through just a smattering, just a little selection of stories of the Democrats just being unrepentant hypocrites about this particular topic, the First Amendment, censorship, cancel culture. And I want to go off on this a little bit, because there's a distinct lack of discrimination out there these days. And what I mean by that is that there's a bizarre paradigm that occurs where Jimmy Kimmel gets fired, the MAGA supporters celebrate it, and then you've got some MAGA supporters going, whoa, 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 I didn't think we were about cancel culture. This seems like cancel culture to me, and we're supposed to be against that, so I'm against this. And it's like, do you not have the ability to tell the difference between somebody like Jimmy Kimmel, who mocked and lied about a major violent event, as America itself is in this heightened state of tension, everybody's scared of this conflict spilling out into widespread violence, and he's up there lying about what happened, blaming it on Trump supporters, blood libeling half the United States, and he thinks he's going to get away with it? Okay, there's a difference between that and then him just getting fired, okay, because, by the way, the outlets, the TV network stations, the local stations that syndicate his program didn't want his program anymore. And by the way, there could be a part of this, just like with Stephen Colbert. I bet they really, really wish they waited with Stephen Colbert. They could have made so much more out of this. If they'd known this was coming up, I guarantee you they would have held on to Stephen Colbert for another month. His show got canceled like last month, and they gave him a big prize for being a stooge. If they'd waited, ooh, how much they could make out of this. They could make so much hay out of this right now, because these platforms are not profitable. The late night shows are passe. Nobody watches them anymore. Nobody cares about them anymore. They don't make money. They cost a ton of money. Even just having a studio audience, that is a huge cost, huge expense. The insurance, I mean, they're not money makers. So they want to get rid of these programs anyway. So why not have your late night host say something objectionable, fire him over that. You're going to fire him anyways, losing money, but blame it on Trump. And now he's a martyr. And now, oh, it's the First Amendment's under attack. It's not. These guys were going the way of the dodo bird anyway. They just, are weaponizing it and using that fact to try to score some political points. But for our audience out there, for the people that actually are concerned about free speech, don't worry about Jimmy Kimmel. Don't feel like you're being a hypocrite here. You're not. There's a major difference between somebody being let go from their, national high-profile late-night show because they made an abominable statement that, of course, reveals his character. And it's not just like, oh, we're offended. It's like, it's literally a dangerous thing to do. It's literally dangerous. For both sides, a young man was just murdered And you're going to go up there and downplay it and lie about it and blame the victim? I mean, it's just, it's despicable. There's a big difference between that and like Roseanne Barr being fired from the very same organization, ABC, because she said Valerie Jarrett looks like a character from Planet of the Apes. She does. Big difference, okay? So for some reason, you know, you could technically, I guess, label both of these cancel culture because both of the shows got canceled, but are you really not able to discriminate where one is a valid and appropriate response and the other is a hysterical nonsense response? Is that not obvious to everybody? I mean, I've got, you know, I've got examples here. I just read one at the end of the Alex Jones Show. What about this one from 2020? ESPN pulls announcer Robert Lee from Virginia game because of his name. There's an Asian guy named Robert Lee that they didn't allow to announce a game, fired him from his position because his name sounds like a Civil War general. Is that the same thing? Are these two equal things? Somebody losing their job because their name sounds like a guy that the liberals decided to start demonizing from 200 years ago versus Jimmy Kimmel blood libeling half the country and lying about a major devastating and violent event. These are not the same. You have to be able to discriminate. You have to be able to discern. You can't just go, I'm against cancel culture. All cancel culture is bad. It's like, well, what does that mean? What do you determine to be canceled? Does that mean nobody can ever be fired ever? No, obviously not. Like, think about it this way. Think about it this way. If during Black Lives Matter, you had a teacher or a nurse making a video holding their phone going, y'all see George Floyd got that? Man, I love, we should do that to more black people. I think police should hunt more black people like that. He was choking. Oh, it was so funny. And people probably did. People probably did make videos like that. Would anybody on our side have been confused if they got fired from their job? Would anybody here or anybody on the right wing see a video of somebody mocking George Floyd's death, calling for more death like that? And then go, but they shouldn't be fired. No, we'd go, yeah, you're going to be fired, dude. You just, what? You mocked the guy's death? Like, I mean, you can have your political statements, but come on. Obviously, you know, a big corporation is going to fire you if you make something so obviously and like purposefully objectionable. We wouldn't have defended that. We wouldn't have acted outraged or been shocked that somebody mocking George Floyd's death on their personal social media account suffered consequences for that. I mean, they, you know, Black Lives Matter, they would actually destroy your life. Like, they would, like, find you and, like, dox you and try to SWAT you. I mean, they're actually bad, which is the whole point of my entire rant. They're actually bad. Cancel culture, when it's focused on us, is things like, your name scares us, so you can't have a job anymore. You insulted a woman who looks like a monkey. Your show is over. It's just absurd. But taking people off the air when they are so clearly hostile against half of America, downplaying and mocking the brutal death of this young man. I mean, you don't have, you know, it's a late night show. You don't have to, you know, wear a veil and mourn Charlie Kirk, but he lied about it deliberately. And that is actually in violation of the FCC guidelines, which say that you can't knowingly spread false information about a violent event. And you can't spread false information that has the potential to cause real-world violent consequences, which is exactly what Jimmy Kimmel did. But I still think it's a giant scam. I think this is ABC wanting to fire Jimmy Kimmel anyway, and just using this as an excuse to make it look like they're martyrs when really they just aren't making any money. That's just my assumption. That's just my speculation there. But they go, you know, I've just got this stack of, you know, what about this? This was back in 2024. So just 1 year ago, the Supreme Court decided that the Biden administration had an absolute right to force social media companies to censor anything they wanted. And they did. And of course, we have the statements from Facebook. Quote, Facebook admit they censored anyone that the Biden administration told them to. Quote, we didn't ask questions. So these lying scumbag leftists who, for the first time, are actually seeing real appropriate consequences for their insane behavior has suddenly decided like Alex and Alex were talking about, like Alex was talking about with Alex Newman. The road to Damascus moment. They've all woken up all of a sudden and realized the value of the First Amendment. Isn't that amazing? Isn't that amazing? That the very people who have systematically eliminated huge swaths of American speech, the moment that it even breezes by them, they're suddenly the number one First Amendment activist. Spare me. Spare me. Okay? Now, I'm not calling for doing to you what you did to us. That is tyrannical. And we were against it because it was tyrannical. Because you had things back then, and I showed this on the Alex Jones Show again, but if you're just tuning in, I'll go over it once more. And this is the, again, just the absolute beyond hypocrisy of these people. You've got Hakeem Jeffries putting out a statement on the suspension of Jimmy Kimmel, calling it horrible. Oh, that's right, I crumpled up the paper and threw it in the trash to symbolize what I felt about it earlier. So I don't actually have the story, but I have the blank tweet here. But it's Hakeem Jeffries, House Democrat leadership statement on the suspension of Jimmy Kimmel. And they're outraged and they're horrified. And I guess they completely forgot about the fact that Chuck Schumer and Hakeem Jeffries sent a joint letter to Rupert Murdoch of the Fox News Corporation demanding that Tucker Carlson be taken off the air because he was saying things they didn't like. Now, Tucker Carlson was not justifying a murder. He was not downplaying or lying about an attack of a right-winger on a left-winger. He was showing evidence that the election was stolen. It's not hypocrisy. It's something more. It's super hypocrisy. It's hypocrisy plus. So the very people that used their office wrote a threatening letter on official Senate stationery, wielding and weaponizing all of the authority they have as elected officials in this country to try to force a news corporation to take off an anchor because he was saying the truth about what they're doing. He was saying factual things about the 2020 election, and they tried to use their power to silence him and get him taken off the air. And they have the temerity, the balls, the chutzpah to come back and cry foul at Jimmy Kimmel being removed when it wasn't even the government that did it. It wasn't even the government that did it. ABC did it. The affiliates did it. They chose to take Jimmy Kimmel off on their own volition. It was not a pressure campaign by the Trump administration. If it was, it would have been valid and appropriate because they did violate the strictures of their FCC license. So I'm not even saying they shouldn't do that anyway, but they didn't. Unlike Hakeem Jeffries and Chuck Schumer, who did try to weaponize their power, did try to use the power of the American government to silence their opponents and get somebody fired. So just, again, I'm just laying this out for you so you can know that you don't have to entertain these ideas. You don't have to worry about their assertions of caring about the First Amendment. They're liars. They're ridiculous, blatant liars, and you can just ignore them. And we should. And many of us are. What about things like this? Rolling Stone. Now what they're saying is September 11, 2025, people are losing their job for criticizing slain free speech advocate Charlie Kirk. It's just terrible. It's just terrible. They're losing it, which is a little different than 2 years ago, February 2023, when they wrote an article called "Why Cancel Culture is Good for Democracy." These people don't care. They don't care, and they're hypocrites. I get it. You could say, well, aren't you a hypocrite? Well, you were against cancel culture then, but you're not against it now. What did I say about discrimination? What did I say about discernment? Not all cancel culture is equal. What these people were defending was firing nobodies from their jobs. You know, firing not celebrities, but just, you know, firing people that work at the dog salon or whatever for not taking a vaccine, for saying they thought the election was stolen, for saying that COVID came from a lab. For saying true things. There's a difference between somebody being punished for knowingly lying to pursue a violent and divisive agenda versus somebody fired or demonized or criticized or punished in some way for actually just saying the verbatim truth. You don't have to listen. They don't believe anything. Just going to reemphasize that over and over until it breaks through. This is one of the better ones. This is one of the funnier ones. So it's a guy named P.E. Moskowitz. at @_PEM_PEM. He says, TikTok owned by far-right conglomerate, Twitter owned by a Nazi, every TV station bending the knee, anyone who doesn't follow directives getting sued into silence. America has been great, but America's never been great, but we at least had free-ish speech. What will we have after this? Now, I could get into everything he said here, but let's just take it at face value. Let's assume what he says is correct. This is the book he wrote. P.E. Moskowitz, The Case Against Free Speech, The First Amendment, Fascism, and the Future of Dissent. There's a meme that goes around. It's not even a meme. It's not the right thing. It's a saying. It's a idiom, which says something like, when I'm weak, I beg for leniency. I beg for diversity, because that's in line with your ideology. So I'll play on that. I'll weaponize that. I'll lean on that to insinuate myself into your group. Hey, you believe in free speech, don't you? That's your value? Well, then you have to let me speak. But then when I'm in power, we go by my rules and my values, and I don't actually value free speech. That's how these people are. Now that their speech is actually having just a modicum of appropriate consequence, they're First Amendment champions. It's bad enough you people are tyrannical. It's bad enough you people are as hypocritical, as devious, as low down as you are. But I feel insulted. But on top of it all, I feel like you're insulting my intelligence with this, and you're insulting all of our intelligences. You think we can't see what you're doing? You think you can pretend to make a heartfelt plea for the First Amendment now, after 10 years of eradicating the First Amendment as rapidly and as thoroughly as you possibly can? I feel insulted. I feel like you must think I'm as dumb as you are. So don't fall for it. Don't fall for it. The man crying foul of, oh, TikTok is being owned by a right winger. And he wrote a book. Free speech is fascist, actually. Okay. We're just trying not to be fascist, okay? You people taught us free speech is the top thing a fascist can do. I mean, what's the proof that Elon Musk is a Nazi? He brought free speech to Twitter, obviously. So, hey, we want to avoid being a Nazi. And you people have taught us free speech, number one Nazi idea. So we're going to be avoiding that. And these people are it hurts my mind to even have to contend with this. But these people are out there saying things, so we have to as well. David Pakman, what is this? Tennis lessons at age 28, I began transitioning, but picking up a racket made my body mine. Oh, okay. That's P.E. Moskowitz. Hey, P.E. Moskowitz, stick to pickleball. Crew laughed at that one. I don't even know what it means. I mean, you're not worthy of the glorious and graceful game of tennis, okay? Stick to your little paddle game. I'm not an elitist about most things, but I spit on pickleball. And P.E. Moskowitz. David Pakman, one of the ones, y'all, one of the examples God has given us. David Pakman says, one of the hallmarks of authoritarianism is to terrify people into self-censorship. ABC ending Kimmel show is a perfect example of this. Cut to big win for the battle of ideas. And free speech, Roseanne said she wanted to say ABC made the business decision that was right for them. Boo-hoo, Roseanne. Boo-hoo, we win. We win the battle of ideas and free speech because we got you fired for daring to insult an ugly woman. Meanwhile, one of the hallmarks of authoritarianism. Just shut up. Just shut up. You're embarrassing yourself, okay? The only solution for you now is to have a—and look— what they need to do is have a real honest-to-God moment, recognizing that we're right and have been right about everything. Now, they're not going to do that. Don't think for a single second they're going to do anything like that. This is a joke I'm making here. They would never do that. They never will. They never have. But they should. And if they did, they'd have to recognize we're right about everything. You can't just say, well, they were right about free speech, just so happened to be, but wrong about everything. No. We're right about everything. Follow it to its logical conclusion. What they should be thinking now is, gee, that was stupid of us to be so heinously tyrannical for the last 10 years. Gee, that sure is coming back to bite us in the ass, just like they said it would. Just like every time anybody argued this, we said, where do you think this stops, dude? Where do you think it goes? We actually want free speech. That's what we've been actually fighting for this entire time. These people just want destruction, division. They just want a free hand to lie and deceive and manipulate and screw people over. We actually want to tell the truth. We actually want to say what we truly believe. So we can actually understand the world around us in order to deal with it correctly. These people want nothing but obfuscation and deceit. It's sickening. I've got more. Do you want more? An endless number. Yeah, Jimmy Kimmel suspended and Antifa declared domestic terrorists. And that's another one. I see people going, if you declare Antifa a domestic terrorist, like, what if they do it to right-wingers next? And it's like, okay, first of all, InfoWars has been officially declared an extremist organization by the FBI since 2013. So what's the risk exactly? Oh, no, they might do it to us. They've been doing it to us for 12 years. Now we're actually doing it to them. And it's not about a tit-for-tat, eye for an eye. It's about they set the precedent, we rise to meet it. It's a necessity in a system by which precedent setting is a major and primary control factor of behavior. So they do it to us, we do it to them. This is easy. By the way, InfoWars sits in front of a camera and tells the truth. Antifa is out there shooting people in the chest, like Aaron Danielson, burning down buildings, attacking ICE officers, throwing rocks at cop cars. They actually are domestic terrorists. Good they're being charged with that. And it strikes it to me like that argument where people go, well, but what if they declare Antifa as a terrorist organization and now everybody on the right wing is going to be a terrorist? And it's like that sounds an awful lot to me like the arguments leftists make about illegal immigration, where they're like, oh, they're going to go after illegal immigrants. Is it going to be American citizens next? And it's like, no, it's actually not. And I think if you have never put on a black mask and gone out to hit a right winger with a steel pole, I don't think you have anything to worry about. If you're not in the criminal groups, why would you care about the criminal groups being rounded up? Just like if you're an illegal immigrant, why would you care about illegal immigrants rounding you up? Discernment, folks, discrimination. Not everything is just a blanket statement that encapsulates everything.
Thank you all for meeting with me. You're all doing some wonderful work destroying the world, but I think it's probably time for us to reevaluate.
Yes, sorry for the interruption, but I think we're in the wrong meeting. We're not here to destroy the world. We're here to save it. You see, we are some of the leading leaders of liberal causes, and I'm with the Human Rights Campaign, who focus on LGBTQ+ and trans rights. You see, I have an equal sign to let you know that I'm a good person.
Ooh. Oh, excuse me, women's reproductive rights.
Oh. Climate.
Free Palestine.
Open borders. I misspoke before. You guys are not destroying the world, okay? You are saving the world.
Hey, whoa, what's up with those scare quotes?
Pretty sure I didn't use scare quotes when I said saving the world. The important thing to keep in mind is that there's a big election coming up, and you and I, we're all on the same page, okay? So if we want Biden to win, he needs to win in order for us to save the world. If we want Biden to win, you folks, how can I say this? You might need to tone it down just...
Tone down what?
Oh, that's a good question. You're women's reproductive rights, right? Okay. Excellent branding, by the way. I see it's a much easier on the ears than baby murder, so kudos to you on that one. But opposing any restrictions all the way through to the ninth month, I mean, you see how you're kind of tipping your hand, right? Makes people think, wait, maybe they actually want to kill babies. And we do, obviously.
No, we don't.
Oh.
No, we don't. We don't.
Right. We don't. But you see how it can kind of look that way. So that's all I'm saying. You know, let's tone it down. And you, immigration, clearly we don't want a completely open border that undermines any sense of national sovereignty, driving down wages for the working class and overtaxing the welfare state. So let's go a bit easy there, too. I mean, why not something like this? Why not something like diversity is our...
Are you trying to say diversity is our strength?
Yes! How do you say that without laughing? Oh, my gosh.
I can't even get through it. This is head and moi. Ah, my sides. My goodness. Okay, what about you?
Pro-Palestine. You are, I'm going to say this. You're kind of coming across like you just want to wipe Israel off the map and kill all the Jews.
We do want to wipe Israel off the map and kill all the Jews.
Of course, yes, yes. And that's awesome. I'm all for that. I love that. But you need to pretend like you don't want to wipe Israel off the map and kill all the Jews.
Why?
Excuse me?
I mean, we're pretty clear in our position, and most young people and everyone on college campuses, and half the Democratic Party, of course, still support us.
Yeah, it's cool now.
You may have a point there. You might be the only person in here that can be as evil as you want to be and get away with it.
Absolutely incredible stuff. I think it's a Babylon Bee skit, if I'm not mistaken. Sounds like one. I don't know who that guy. The guy playing Satan is a very good actor. I love it. And there's something fundamentally true about the skit we just watched. This is War Room. Of course, I'm your host, Harrison Smith. Laura Logan will be taking over from me very shortly, and she's got some great guests lined up for you, including BX on X. Becca is coming on with her. But I got a lot of videos to show you, and I got a lot of news to get to. And let me just say, since we have this time, Benjamin Netanyahu just came out with a video denying killing Charlie Kirk. Benjamin Netanyahu came out with a video denying killing Charlie Kirk, which I'm pretty sure that was me. I'm pretty sure I sort of caused that, but I didn't really cause it, did I? And this is the thing. People, like, it's almost like they're running the script without my, like, ignoring my tweet. Okay? Because everything that is being said by Netanyahu and some of these other people makes perfect sense if the claim that Israel may have been out to kill Charlie Kirk came from speculation. If it came from just, you know, people coming up with that and just wanting that to be true, then it doesn't really make any sense. The problem is, if you want to identify the first person to accuse Israel of killing Charlie Kirk, it was Charlie Kirk. He's the one that said it. I just reported it a month before it happened. So, but then they're acting like that doesn't exist. They're acting like Charlie Kirk is number one Zionist in America. He gets murdered, and everybody just for no reason goes, "We think this was Israel," but that's not the case. Charlie Kirk said it. I talked to somebody with the knowledge, who knew that that's what he said, and I tweeted it out a month before he was killed. That's where this starts. That's where this begins. So when people are just like, wow, this crazy idea, it's like, would it be crazy to say that a husband murdered a wife if the wife is telling her friends, "I think my husband's going to kill me," and then she ends up murdered? It's like, no, that's where you start. So they want to act like it's being anti-Israel that makes people, you know, question this. No, it was Charlie Kirk himself that said, "I think Israel's going to kill me if I move away from them." And without that, yeah, it doesn't make any sense. Now, without that, it is just baseless speculation. But that exists, and it's time-stamped, a month before he was murdered. You can't ignore that. And I've said over and over, I don't see much evidence that Israel has anything to do with it. I see some very suspicious connections here or there. If you look into some of the plane stuff, that's, you know, pretty bombshell stuff. And if you look at the way this suspect is behaving and the messages that he sent, it's very suspicious. It's all very suspicious. But I just want to remind everybody, the first person to claim that Israel would kill Charlie Kirk was Charlie Kirk. So if you're, you know, worried about people like using his memory or, you know, for their own ends, it's like he said this. So I just want to put that out there as a reminder. That's where this idea comes from. My tweet that I heard verbatim, somebody with the knowledge to know, who I kind of wish would come out and just go public with it. Because I get that it's like, you know, not as easy to believe somebody saying, "I heard from somebody else said," but I did, and I tweeted it out before it happened. So that's where this claim comes from, just to be perfectly clear. So you really can't say that, you know, it's just made up out of nowhere, out of anti-Israel sentiment. That's how I feel about it. And I, by the way, I have a genuine invitation to Bibi Netanyahu. Come on the show. Come on the show, Bibi. Come on the show, buddy. Now, I'm not the Nelk boys. I'm not going to follow a script, but come on the show. Benjamin Netanyahu wants to call in, wants to Zoom in. You're not coming to the studio. We're not stupid. But if you want to digitally connect, yeah, let's do it. Come on. We can put all this to bed, okay? But to act like this is a ridiculous claim, it only exists because a month before Charlie was murdered, he was telling his close friends, I'm afraid Israel's going to kill me if I keep moving against them. And then he kept moving against them. And then he ended up dead in front of everybody with a patsy that nobody buys the story about. Just saying. I'm just saying. It doesn't come from a source of anti-Israel sentiment. It comes from the impossible to fake pre-knowledge that Charlie Kirk seemed to have. Okay, so that's all I have to say about that. Now, I do have some more comments on Charlie Kirk in general and, you know, how this is being treated. I actually thought this was good. As much as we demonize and want to, well, and this is kind of both, but, you know, when famous people say horrible things, we want to highlight it to illustrate the darkness of their souls. In this case, it's the opposite. Rainn Wilson, who played Dwight on The Office, is secretly based. And I've been telling you this for a while. He's actually very, like, he seems like a very good guy, and he seems like he is not the typical Hollywood celebrity. But he calls out some Hollywood celebrities here, and he has the proper amount of respect for Charlie Kirk, who was just murdered. So as much as we like to demonize the left when they do things bad, let's celebrate the left when they do something right. And I do believe Rainn Wilson would consider himself a leftist. He is at least in the Hollywood establishment. And here he is saying he's kind of disgusted at the things people are saying behind the scenes. Clip two.
Country is being torn apart in so many different ways. While I didn't agree with his ideas, shooting someone that we disagree with, even if they're vociferous and loud and out there, is so colossally wrong-headed. I spoke to a couple of, let's say, some liberal friends last night at an event, and they were like, you won't find me shedding any tears. And someone else was like, oh, well, it was a little bit of a kind of a good riddance thing. And it's like, guys, no.
Yeah, I know.
No.
I know.
We cannot think or talk that way.
Not at all.
That is not
it's
okay.
So dangerous, man.
Who's that guy he's talking to? Plays the Hulk. What's his name? Mark Ruffalo. That guy's so full of crap. He is like the number one. It's like him and Mark Hamill are the top, like, soy boy, boomer, retard Hollywood airheads. So, you know, for him to be like, oh, it's totally unacceptable. He's so foolish. Go look up Mark Ruffalo, what he's been saying about Trump supporters in the past. He's the worst. So, but Rainn Wilson seems to be telling the truth, and good on him if he really did, you know, say something. But I don't know if he did. But he's relating that he's at a party and people are going, Charlie Kirk had it coming. And of course, if you're in that position, it is your obligation and responsibility to say, what the hell is wrong with you? How dare you? You need to leave. I'm serious. Don't argue with them. Don't try to justify them. Don't go on the back foot. Assert your moral certainty. I keep saying that because this is the most clear-cut example we've ever had in our lives of being on the absolute unambiguous good side of the argument. You do not kill a man for his words. Assert that with certainty. And don't do the thing that we do, because I know I do it too. Trust me, I'm guilty of this. You hear liberals saying BS and you just grimace or you smile and and later you talk about it on your radio show. I do it. We all do. Now is not the time. Now is the time to shove it down their throats, okay? Please, please, for the love of goodness, do that for Charlie Kirk. Now, I want to go to a few more videos that, again, might further obscure, but might also illustrate and illuminate what may have really been going on with the assassination of Charlie Kirk. We'll go to clip number 13 first, CIA connections to the university where the shooting happened and the shooter's connections to some of these programs. Let's watch.
Okay, does anyone else think it's odd that Tyler Robinson, the Charlie Kirk shooting suspect, heads to Utah State University, a school with uniquely heavy CIA ties, for just one semester in 2021 as a pre-engineering major, then mysteriously drops out and heads back home? He was a bright kid, top 1%, ACT score of 34, 4.0 GPA in high school, and got a $32,000 presidential scholarship. The university's Center for Anticipatory Intelligence, the nation's first program of its kind, led by ex-CIA analyst Jeannie Johnson and co-founded by former CIA Assistant Director Matt Barrett, actively recruits STEM kids like Tyler for its interdisciplinary intelligence training. There are no known direct connections yet, but with the USU's strong CIA and Israeli ties via over $2.4 million in research grants, you have to wonder what sparked the sudden exit. What do you guys think? Comment below.
So people are digging and they're finding connections like this. You know, we watched this live, this hearing. I haven't actually done any due diligence on this, but while we were watching it live, it was kind of like, okay, he's not going to say anything. And then I started thinking about it. I was like, well, why didn't he say anything? What? And is that normal? And I don't actually know. Is it normal to have, you know, for the first appearance in court, they don't normally speak? Is that not when you would lodge a response, guilty or not guilty? No? Okay. It seemed weird to me. It seemed weird to me that they bring him on. He looks like all, like, drugged out and doesn't say anything, and then they just usher him off again. Oh, he does say something. Okay. It is kind of similar to James Holmes. He's got kind of a similar look, too. The whole thing is weird, man. The whole thing is bizarre. The whole thing is kind of questionable as far as I can tell. Let's go to clip number 7 here, because this is a guy with the same rifle that the shooter had. And he's showing how to... It's a circus in town, boys. Chris, I don't know what the crew's doing. Clip number 7 here. A man demonstrates exactly how long it takes to actually disassemble and reassemble the rifle that was used in the shooting. Let's watch. Oh, it's from that video.
On this episode of You Might Be a Dumb Motherfucker, this is my rifle.
Ah,
it takes two different tools to take it apart.
I'm sorry. We got to take this down. Long story short, I forgot to censor it. We can let it play just without the audio. But you see here how long it takes. He's got to grab his Allen key. He's got to take it apart. And the whole time he's talking about, like, you know, if you've just shot somebody, your hands are shaking. It's much more difficult to do the sort of precise movements necessary. So it's already been 15, 20 seconds. Now, in the video, the kid doesn't stop at all. He just is running immediately as soon as the shot's fired. And then there's the additional, you know, idea that you're going to reassemble a rifle with a scope, but you're not going to sight it in, and you're going to get basically a bullseye on your first shot. That's kind of hard to believe. But if you look at the videos that have been provided so far of the kid getting to the, you know, where he fired the shot, he's still trying to take it apart. It's still 47 seconds in. Okay. So this is part of the official story that still I haven't seen it, you know, figured out. So he says, he's like, I've taken this rifle apart and put it back together 1,000 times. So he's doing it with really, you know, expertise behind it. But then he shows how long the pieces still are, and they're much longer than the backpack that we see the kid have. It's sticking like 2 feet out of the backpack. And then we've got, I don't know if we still have the video, but we had a video a few days ago of the governor, Spencer Cox, of Utah, trying to explain the quick-changing routine that this kid was going through. He's like, well, he climbed up there, and then he changed, and then he fired the shot, and then he changed, and then he went down and hid in the bush, and then he changed clothes there. And it's like, wait, what? And it just doesn't make any sense. The exact timeline, and this is why I was saying when I was on with Alex when they were doing the press conference, like, they were describing video that shows every step of the attack. You have to release that video if you want people to believe us, but to believe you. It may be true. I'm not saying it's not true. They could have video footage. In fact, they do. In fact, the video that you're seeing now has in its purview, in its angle of view, the place where the sniper was. So that this same video that we're seeing, if you were to back it up about 30 seconds, if they were to provide to us the full video, 30 seconds before this video would be him firing the shot from a prone position on the corner of the roof in view of this camera. But they didn't release that for some reason. I still am not totally positive I'm seeing a big long rifle in this video. Maybe it's there. Maybe it's in the sort of sweatshirt or towel that he's carrying. Maybe, but it kind of doesn't seem like that. I don't know. I'm really not. I'm about 25% confident that we have the right guy. I'm about 100% confident that he had accomplices. In fact, I am 100% confident because one of them has been caught and arrested and in possession of child porn, apparently. So add that to the mix. Add that to the equation and see what, you know, comes out on the other side. But we've got some more, you know, questions about this that I look forward to the FBI answering. And in the press conference, he's going, we have on video. We have him going here to here. We have him going there to there. And it's like, cool, great. Can't wait to see those videos on the screen. Once you show them to us, we will believe you. But why are you describing videos and not providing the videos? Why would you do that? Even if just like, okay, let's take them completely at face value. They 100% have the guy. They have him on video. They track him the entire time. Why would you not want to release that? I mean, wouldn't you want to release it if you know there's all the speculation about Israel? There's all these questions about the left saying that he's not the real shooter, or people on the right talking about all these, you know, alternative angles that he was shot from. Was he shot from a drone? Was he shot from a trapdoor underneath? I mean, wouldn't you want to just put a stop to all that speculation? And couldn't you put a absolute hardcore deadline stop on all of that speculation by releasing the full video? Why aren't they? Are they saving it for trial? Like, why would they do that? I don't know. It's just, if they have this video, they need to put it out. You got to satisfy the people with questions because the questions have not been answered. So we'll wait to see what they come out with. But you know, I talked about sort of the first day that we got back, and I referenced a documentary series by a YouTuber named Coop, C-O-O-P, Coop. He did a 3-part series on the Vegas shooting, and in that documentary, it reminds you that, like, on that day, on October 1st, was it 2017, I believe, or was it 2018? On the day of the Vegas shooting, there were thousands of 911 calls recorded of people talking about gunfire all over the city. First-hand accounts, not, hey, I heard it, but, like, we're in the Tropicana, there's gunfire above us. Thousands of calls, thousands of witnesses contradicting the main story. The guy who was on stage, Al Dean, goes on Tucker Carlson and says, my bass player got a bullet lodged in his bass. That bass player was facing directly away from Mandalay Bay. How does a bullet fired from behind him lodge itself in the front of his bass guitar? That was 7 years ago. Go on any site, go on any news site, Wikipedia, Google, search the Las Vegas shooting, all you get is Stephen Paddock, lone wolf, by himself, no motive. When you want to talk about the cover-ups the deep state is able to pull off, it's unbelievable. It's unbelievable what they're able to cover up. They don't even cover it up. I mean, it's like we know what happened. We have all this crazy footage that just fully debunks everything about the mainstream story, but the mainstream story is all you will ever hear from here until the end of time. It'll be in the history books. Stephen Paddock acted alone, by himself. He was a professional gambler with no motive. Now, they don't even mention the emails that we have from Stephen Paddock saying that he's a CIA agent, but there are those. You got to go watch these documentaries. They're very good. But the point is that, like, just because we have a patsy, just because we have some electronic text messages that look like they're written by a foreign robot. I mean, this is not proof. This is not proof. I'm not satisfied. I don't think you should be satisfied with what they've given us so far. And I think you should be suspicious about what they're able to withhold in terms of information about these very important. I mean, the Vegas shooting was the biggest mass shooting ever. And it's on video. You can hear two different machine guns going off back and forth. Oh, by the way, here's a video of the shooting happening, and the windows of the Mandalay Bay haven't been broken out yet. That's kind of interesting, isn't it? We got to like air this stuff. Maybe I'll reach out to the guy who made it. It is such a really powerful and I think important documentary coup on YouTube, Las Vegas shooting. But again, it's not even about the Las Vegas shooting. It's about the awareness of what the government is capable of, what the mainstream media is capable of, what the CIA is capable of, the cover-up they're able to pull off in front of everybody. So, hey, do we have the right guy? Hey, maybe we watch the video and you see him walk up, fire. I mean, maybe they got everything. Maybe. I can't wait to see it. I'll believe it when I do. Till then, keep trying. Keep trying, FBI. Keep trying, Netanyahu. We're going to keep asking questions because that's our right as Americans. And you can call us whatever names you want. The fact is, it all started with Charlie himself saying in his own words that he thought Israel was going to kill him. So there it is. By the way, Ron Unz at the Unz Report just came out with an article where he says that his sources inside the White House and inside the Charlie Kirk camp say that everybody involved is sure that Israel has something to do with it, which is what I've been saying the whole time, because everybody who knew Charlie Kirk really intimately has made this the center point of their coverage. Like, Tucker Carlson has not said that Israel did it, but every time he's been on air since Charlie Kirk's murder, his main talking point is Charlie's disagreement with Israeli donors, his opposition to the Iranian war. I mean, that's what Tucker Carlson has made the center point of everything he said, which I think is a signal to us. I think we can be smart enough to pick up on that. But it's Matt Gaetz, it's Roger Stone, it's Tucker Carlson, it's Megyn Kelly, it's Candace Owens, it's people that really knew and loved Charlie Kirk and who aren't beholden to a foreign state. They're the ones that are coming out and saying this. And Charlie Kirk was the first to say it out of all of them. Now, Laura Logan's going to take over for me in the next 2 hours. Very excited to see her incredible guest and breaking incredible news. Please make sure to go to thealexjonesstore.com, thealexjonesstore.com. Take advantage of the year anniversary sale and get your Life is Fiery with Your Beauty, Life is Fiery with Its Beauty merch, the Crusader merch, tons of new stuff, tons of sales. Become a VIP member, support us, keep us on the air in the fight and pursuing truth wherever it leads. TheAlexJonesStore.com. Laura Logan on the other side. Don't go anywhere.
Enter the so-called Podesta plan, a plan that isn't a single neatly titled document you can Google in a heartbeat. It's the insidious undercurrent of strategies hatched by John Podesta, the longtime Clinton operative and Obama whisperer, to weaponize division, radicalize the masses, and claw back power through engineered unrest. And at its rotten heart, the Podesta plan emerges from the WikiLeaks trove of over 50,000 emails hacked from Podesta's Gmail in 2016.
This is a legitimate email. John needs to change his password immediately. So the IT team said, yes, John, reset your password at that bit.ly link. Well, they actually say reset it at myaccount.google.com, which is the right link, but he just went back to the original email and used the bit.ly link, and then he got hacked.
These weren't just chit-chat about pizza parties. They revealed a calculated machine. Podesta, as Hillary's campaign chair and founder of the left-wing think tank Center for American Progress, plotting to plant the seeds of the revolution in America. One bombshell email from 2012 penned by activist Sandy Newman to Podesta floated the idea of hijacking religious voters for a progressive uprising.
What Kirk said was dangerous. What Kirk said was racist, rooted in white supremacy, nasty, and hate-filled.
Fast forward through the leaks and you see the blueprint solidify. Coordinate with media allies to amplify outrage, fund agitators through shadowy foundations, and stoke racial and cultural fault lines to delegitimize elections. It's not about winning votes. It's about winning the narrative war, turning dissent into dynamite.
Reaction to the Trump type?
Well, my reaction is it's disgusting. And I think people saw in real life what we've been saying for a long time, what Hillary said as far back as June, is that he's unfit to be president of the United States.
Ladies and gentlemen, the president-elect of the United States, Donald John Trump.
Post-2016, as Trump stormed the gates, Podesta and his ilk didn't slink away. They doubled down. Remember James Carville, the raging Cajun himself, teaming up with Podesta and leaked chats right after the election? They schemed to paint Trump as an existential threat to minorities and immigrants, priming blue cities for secession and street-level sabotage.
Trump is a criminal. And criminals like to be around other criminals.
And a mob boss.
Yeah. Yeah.
Podesta's fingerprints are everywhere, from emails coordinating with CNN's Donna Brazile to rigged town halls to whispers of pressuring donors like Saudi Arabia and Qatar over ISIS funding while ignoring Clinton Foundation ties.
But most scandalous is that one of the biggest donors to the supposedly progressive team is the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia, currently massacring dissidents in its own country, as well as thousands of Yemeni civilians. The Saudi regime funds the Clintons with at least tens of millions of dollars. And in 2015, the Saudi government also started paying $140,000 per month to the Podesta group.
Now, zoom to today, and the Podesta plan isn't theory. It's fully operational. With Trump back in the saddle and the deep state reeling, sources are buzzing about a Podesta-led Democrat plan for 1,500 protests across all 50 states, scripted riots in L.A., and false flags to frame Trump as a dictator, all to ignite a civil war scenario and seize power. Podesta is not just advising on climate scams like the Inflation Reduction Act's $370 billion green slush fund.
As Karine noted, we're marking the one-year anniversary of a truly transformative piece of legislation, the Inflation Reduction Act, which is the largest investment in clean energy and climate action ever in the United States, in the history of the world. But first, I want to acknowledge that today's event is coming during a time of heartbreak as the toll of extreme weather fueled by climate change is being felt across the country and the world.
Now it's just how to get the money out as fast as possible before they come in and, like, fuck up. It truly feels like we're on the Titanic and we're throwing, like, gold bars off the top hatch.
He's the architect of the unrest that keeps the masses distracted while the elite consolidate. This is the Podesta plan, an orchestrated uprising, riding out into this very day.
Well, hello there. This is Lara Logan filling in on the War Room. And one of the first things I want to get right to it today, one of the first things that we want to talk about here is Kash Patel made a number of headlines with his testimony in front of the House Oversight Committee yesterday. And one of the things that he talked about was these networks of online organizations. The one that he referenced particularly was the 764 Network, which are these satanic cults that have proliferated with the proliferation of technology. And their main thing is that they really go after our children. If parents don't know about the 764 Network, they really should. Now, they're not the only people that are in that. There are many other groups that are involved in this, and we're going to get into that. But just as a start, I want to play this clip of Kash Patel talking about this so you can get a sense of how serious and prolific it is.
Counterterrorism work, cyber attacks, and foreign adversaries are something the FBI must never sleep on, and we are not sleeping. In the counterintelligence space alone, this year, year to date, 30% increase in counterintelligence arrests from the DPRK, Russia, Iran, and China. And I want the American people to know, in this setting, there's a lot of work that the brave men and women in the FBI are doing we just can't get into, but they don't stop. Our cyber threats, ransomware attacks, those harming our children online. We have nearly a 20% increase in indictments and arrests in 7 months alone this year. We're going after those that harm our malware, infrastructure systems, telecom systems, and energy structure. Combating SALT and Vault Typhoons are just a little bit of the examples we're doing. Maybe most importantly, under the counterterrorism and domestic terrorism umbrella, are nihilist, violent extremists, and those that label themselves 764, who wish to go online and convince children to maim and mutilate themselves and commit suicide. And we are producing record numbers of arrests under that umbrella organization. We even stopped an individual in the 764 network who wanted to conspire to kill an adolescent girl. He is now in custody. Transparency remains one of my main priorities at the FBI. And this is what I've done in my 7 months at the helm. We've produced more than 33,000 pages of documents to Congress to a variety of committees, including, I believe, 7,500 to this committee alone, if memory serves me correct. To put the 33,000 in perspective, my predecessor in 7 years produced 13,000 pages.
Now they're talking about these, the 764 network and all these online threats. Why is this so important and relevant in this particular moment? Because when you talk about the trans community, when you talk about furries, who are the crazy people who dress up as animals, and you talk about all of these communities, what do they have in common? Many of them operate online. They follow a satanic agenda. And the number one thing that they're after is your children. So why is there a rise in anxiety amongst kids, panic attacks amongst kids, self-mutilation, self-harm, and what does that lead to? Well, our guest, I have with us a woman, Rebecca Spinks Becker, who is somebody that I have been following for a while now and someone who I have enormous respect for. Becca has been investigating this. She's been at great risk to herself and her own family. She has been looking into this for some time. She's been consistently attacked because, of course, these dark networks that operate, you know, they're well-funded and they have, there's nothing holding them back, right? They want to hurt people. That's part of their agenda. There's even some of them who believe that their job is to commit enough evil to accelerate the decline of humanity. That's why they're called accelerationists. If I sound like I know what I'm talking about, I don't really. Much of what I learned came from this woman, Rebecca, and Becca, just, you know, thank you very, very much for being here and for joining us. You and I have talked before, and I always learn so much from you, and I, it's kind of breathtaking for me because you have been attacked so much. You've even been attacked by former members of the FBI, who shall remain nameless, and very unfairly, and all because you just started investigating and exposing these very real networks that the FBI has since admitted that they have investigations into one of these groups, for example, the 764 network. I believe it's in every field office of the FBI in the United States, which was the first time you were vindicated. Now Kash Patel comes out and testifies like this. This is the second time that you've been vindicated. And I wonder if you can just, that must feel good, right?
Well, it's hard to say. I don't want to say it feels good because it's such a horrible topic. I hate that this kind of evil exists and is so prolific.
Yes.
So it's a terrible thing to be vindicated about. But yes. I'd be lying if I said I didn't feel somewhat relieved that they're taking it seriously and that people are starting to understand. And for what it's worth, I don't think you did a bad job explaining it at all. You actually did a really good job explaining.
You're a good teacher.
What I've coined the term satanic accelerationism, this idea that by corrupting our youth, traumatizing our youth, and committing acts of terror and violence, that they can accelerate the collapse of Western civilization, which they consider to be a threat to their satanic agenda. And that is something that's a bit higher level. A lot of the 764 members who are getting arrested, they might just be more like proxy soldiers, right? They might not actually be adhering to that, but that's the ideology that kind of set them in motion. And so that's what we're seeing right now. We're seeing the output of that.
Okay, so, you know, when a lot of people hear that, number one, it might just be overwhelming, right? And they're like, whoa, this is crazy. I don't want to have anything to do with this. And they just want to move on. But other people hear this and they're like, well, that's bad. But, you know, what has it got to do with me? When you understand how prolific it is and how it's growing, I think it changes your perspective entirely. Can you give us a sense of the breadth of this?
Yeah, so, and I recently just put out an article. This was before the September 10th shooting in Colorado. There was a school shooting in Colorado that kind of went under the radar because of the tragic assassination of Charlie Kirk on the same day. In fact, it was only minutes later that
yes.
the shooting happened. Before that, I'd put out an article saying that the last five high-profile school shooters in the U.S. were connected to these online, what you heard Cash call the nihilistic violent extremists, the NVEs. Which is the FBI's term for what we basically described. It's a much more politically correct term for this group of people who want to accelerate the collapse of society through violence. And they're grooming kids and they're inciting them within these online spaces. They're radicalizing them, provoking them to go commit, you know, terror attacks like school shootings. And so the one in Colorado.
Or kill their parents, right? or hurt their animals, their pets at home. I mean, hurt themselves, cut themselves. Not, you know, people hear cutting and they think, oh, well, that's bad, obviously. Mm-hmm. But they don't, you know, I've seen some of the pictures. You've seen a lot more. But they're teaching kids to cut themselves to the bone.
Right. It becomes a contest of who can do the most evil, horrible thing and get it on camera, or like get the kid to do the most evil thing on camera. It really is a competition within the group. Look what I got this kid to do, right? So they're getting the kids to carve the abusers' usernames into their bodies. They're getting them to kill their pets and arrange, you know, satanic altars with their guts. They're getting them to, you know, grievously self-harm and even kill themselves on camera. I've seen them trying to convince kids to drink bleach. All of these things have led to actual documented deaths of children. So it's definitely something that's getting worse, and it's international too. It's not just in the U.S. And so the FBI really has their work cut out for them, because if they have a victim here in the U.S., there's a chance that their abuser might be in another country. So they're working hard with other countries also to bring these people to justice.
This is what this borderless digital world has brought us, right? Because that's one of the things I was shocked to discover, is that, you know, your child can be right there under your roof, living with you, not far away from you, not away in college or living their own life, but right there with you. And they can be, you know, whatever you call it, trafficked or handled or whatever. They can have not one handler, but many handlers. And it's kind of like a group sport among the handlers to see who has the most power and influence, right? There was, you know, remember the case that you and I talked about before of that young girl in Canada? There was a film made about her in Canada, what happened to her, how she had all those different handlers, and I remember the mother just saying, like, I mean, it's almost like watching your child recede into autism. You know, you just can't reach them. They're right in front of you, but you can't reach them. And that young girl ended up, they wanted her to kill herself in a bloodbath of boiling water with a chain around her neck, her own blood in her own bathroom. Her mother described beating on the door, you know, while her daughter's trying to drown herself. And one of the kids that was responsible, one of the many kids in that group that was doing that to her, turned up in North Carolina. And he was only 18. And I'll never forget, because he wasn't arrested for what he did to her. He was arrested on a separate charge. I think it was child porn. But because of the mom fighting for justice, in spite of the fact that, you know, none of the authorities or law enforcement in Canada cared one bit, they linked that case to her daughter, and that guy admitted it. And when they asked him about why he did what he did, I'll never forget what he said, which was, "I liked the blood."
It's terrifying. That was a very, very powerful documentary done by CBC. I was fortunate enough to be included in the documentary. And when I watched it, I was just in shock at how raw and powerful that conversation was between the mother and her daughter, talking about how she just lost control. She didn't recognize her daughter was brainwashed, like in a cult, right? But within her own, you know, used to when kids join cults, they ran off and you had to go chase them down and
find
them.
Like kidnapped by the Moonies, yeah. Right?
But this is so much more insidious, because it's happening in your own walls, right under your nose.
I know.
It's so difficult to listen. I've had the unfortunate experiences of talking to many victims and their parents. And it really hits close to home, because I don't think a lot of people realize how normal these families are that this is happening to. It's there's always this kind of air of, well, that would never happen to me. That would never happen to my child.
And I know what my child's doing online,
and
blah, blah.
It's terrifying how, like, to think about the complacency that goes along with that attitude. You really have to be so proactive in today's modern world to make sure that your kids are equipped to deal with that, and that you really do understand what's going on.
So for people who want to see you in that documentary, what was it called again? I think it was 5 Points.
It's the Fifth Estate.
Fifth Estate. Mm-hmm. Fifth Estate, who did it. You can find it online. It's not hard to find. Mm-hmm. Out of Canada. And then you did your own series, which I found absolutely enlightening. I remember stumbling across it online on a Saturday night at home, and I watched the first episode and I called my husband. I was like, you have to get home. I have to show you something. And we watched it again. What did you don't have a name. Do you have a name for that series?
No.
It's on your ex account.
I didn't think to name it, because I didn't know how many parts there would be. And it was just kind of a spur of the moment project for me. I'm not a filmmaker. I don't have any experience.
Well, you did a good job.
Thank you. But I've always said I feel like I'm a better writer than I am a speaker. And so when I try to explain this, like you said, you just feel kind of crazy, like people couldn't possibly understand. And so I thought that if I scripted it and explained it very well thought out in a video, that maybe it would help people to understand this very complex topic.
Well, people can find that on X under your handle. What's your handle at BX?
BX underscore on underscore X.
Okay, say it again.
BX underscore on underscore X.
Okay, and you know, in fact, I found also a short clip of a story I think somebody did about you that I think it just, but I want to set it up because it sort of starts in the middle. Mm-hmm. There was an astonishing clip that went viral, right, with this guy, Kyle Spitz.
Oh, yes,
Right? And it was astonishing because he gets shot by this man who is living with his mom, who's his mom's right. boyfriend, and everybody feels very bad for Kyle Spitz. Yeah. And that's where I want to play the clip here. I want to pick it up there so people can see it, because thanks to you, in part, right, people learned much more about Kyle Spitz than first appeared evident.
Yes, that's what happened.
Okay, let's see that clip. We have audio here.
I just want to figure out what's going on. I want to try to get as many of these people behind bars as possible.
This is Beckham. She's a private investigator who hunts online predators. Offline, she also trains as a competitive shooter. She's made 764 her biggest target. For her safety, we're not disclosing where she lives or her last name.
I felt an obligation to do what I could to help the kids, the victims, and to stop these people from doing this to more kids. I saw the video, Kyle Spitz's mom, and that kind of threw me into this world of 764.
At first, yeah. There was no connection between 764 and this chaotic video posted last year by a Tennessee man named Kyle Spitz.
Point that gun at me again.
The shooter was his mother's boyfriend, and as the video went viral, Spitz was initially hailed as a victim.
It wasn't until I started to see victims in the comment section saying, this guy's a member of a satanic cult. He had a 12-year-old victim. That girl had come to me for help. She was very afraid, but she did ultimately decide to go to the police after I talked to her for a while.
Becca posted what she had learned about Spitz, who went by criminal in 764.
And it went like what you would call viral. And it was only a few weeks later that they arrested him. Acid was a friend of Kyle Spitz. He would tell me to quit my reporting or they were going to find me and, rape and murder me. I remember this one time that my daughter was in the bed sleeping next to me and I got this message that said, in 30 minutes, if you don't delete everything about me, I'm going to have your house shot up. And I remember just having this surreal moment of like, I'm living this normal life here with my kid. And then at the same time, I'm being threatened by satanic terrorists. And so I called and made a police report about it.
Police in the UK arrested Acid, whose real name is Cameron Finnegan, last March. The 19-year-old was sentenced to 9 years in prison for encouraging a victim to live stream her own suicide. In this police interview, Finnegan showed no remorse.
The only thing.
It's just incredible. I mean, you know, there's so many things, right? When I see that, I want to point out. Number one, you're just a mom. Like, that's the amazing part. And I know you you had a Twitch stream, online career there for a while. But at the end of the day, the remarkable thing about you, Becca, is that these children cried out for help and you answered their cry. And, you know, I know that you don't talk about your personal life because it's too dangerous for you. I just want to say, like, you embody everything that, you know, that every one of us strives to be.
Thank you.
Because you're doing the right thing for the right reasons. And you don't stop when the risks become more and more and more apparent. You don't stop. And you've been right about everything. I just have to say that for all the detractors out there, it's important for people to know you've been right about everything. And so when you see something like that, I mean, look at the guy threatening you. He's all over. He's the other side of the world in the UK.
Yeah, that was really surreal because that gave me a lot of perspective, actually, because when he was threatening me, it seemed so dangerous and real that I, you know, went to the FBI, you know, and made reports and stuff. I didn't know he was in the UK. For all I know, he could have been
outside the house.
Yeah. So when I found out that he was in the UK and then I saw that video of him getting arrested and crying and, you know, I was like, wow, they take all of these guys' power away when they take them away from their computer. And that's the same thing that happens with the kids. You know, they think they're talking to this big, scary, evil demon who's threatening and extorting them. But once you get them out, once you see them in courtroom, it's just such a surreal and awesome moment because you're like, these people are you know, they have no power and if we take them away from their computer.
You know, they hide behind anonymity, right? They hide behind distance. They are cowards. And you know what it reminds me of? The Wizard of Oz, right? You know how you get that whole thing, you know, you get right to the end of the yellow brick road and pull back the curtain. And who's the wizard? He's just some little old man in his tidy whities, right?
Exactly what
it's just
like,
they're tragic. They're tragic, but they're vulnerable. And the internet gives them power.
Right. Yes. And that's what, you know, that's why it's so awesome to see Kash Patel coming out and saying, we're, and Dan Bongino too, he's made a lot of tweets about it saying that if you're harming children, we don't care how many layers of anonymity you have, we're going to come and find you. Because they do have the ability to find these people. It does take a lot of resources. It's not as simple as it's going in and arresting a, you know, criminal who's committed a real life attack. Because there's not as much forensic evidence. There's not enough. There's not as much investigative. It's all online.
And laws, right? We also lack the laws to prosecute people fully for this.
True. And we've seen a lot of these guys getting terrorism enhancements added to their charges because, you know, they're starting to recognize this as being more than a child exploitation ring. Like you have your standard pedophiles who are terrible, right? Who deserve much stricter sentences than they're getting. But then you have these guys who are not only are they abusing children, sexually abusing children, but they're also terrorists. They're using this as a form of terrorism against the U.S. And so I think that it's important to recognize that because what's happening is a lot of these guys are getting relatively lenient sentences because they're only getting, you know, like you said, rolled up.
Yeah, it's like a grooming thing or something like that, which, you know, when you're trying to get somebody to cut themselves to the bone and murder their parents. I mean, that girl in Canada, her mom said she slept with her door locked for, I think, 2.5 years and locked up the pets at night. Because that's, can you explain the process, like how they sort of reel kids in? Like it starts with gore, right?
Well, you know, it starts with a lot of different places. You know, one place that we've been really focused on lately is Roblox. Roblox is like a child's game where any stranger can come up and start talking to your kid, start grooming them, invite them into a Discord server where they desensitize them with either child abuse material, gore, animal torture, stuff like that to make it seem innocuous and edgy until they can start to get that kind of content from the kids themselves. And then
gore, just so people understand, it's like when you see someone having a car accident and their head flies off or something like that, something gory, right?
It's usually something, it's usually honestly worse. Like it's usually war crimes or dead children, cartel killings, like, you know, really not just gore, but violent gore. Right. Because they're desensitizing them to this like extreme content. And they also, you know, desensitize them to child pornography. And they make it seem like it's kind of cool and edgy. And so the kids become comfortable. And then once they get compromising material from that child, then the relationship turns from like, hey, you're my friend or you're my girlfriend to give me more stuff or I'm going to dox you and SWAT your house or I'm going to kill your entire family or I'm going to send your nudes to your family members. So it's a very scary situation. And a lot of times the kids are just frozen in fear. They don't know what to do. I've talked to a lot of child victims personally. And what's more interesting than anything, I think, is that when I ask them if they'll go to the police, you know, they say no, not because they're afraid of the police, but because they're afraid they're going to get in trouble with their parents.
Wow.
And to me, that's just really impactful as a parent myself, thinking I want my child to know that if anything like that ever happens, they can come to me and be safe. And I think that that's missing in a lot of homes right now because people don't even know it exists.
No, I try to say to parents, it's like, imagine that you, I mean, literally Jeffrey Dahmer, you name it, the worst serial killers and most psychotic criminals you can imagine. It's like opening your front door and saying to all of them, hey, my daughter's room is at the end. And if you're looking for my son, you know, he's on the other side of the house. It's like, and oh, by the way, like stay as long as you like. And you, because parents just don't realize that that's what the internet does. That when your kids are on Discord or even Snapchat, right? and TikTok and YouTube, all of these apps are a kind of portal into these people.
Yes, absolutely.
I know we have to take a break. When we come back after the break, I would love you to break down for us. It's not just 764. There's the maniac murder cult and the Order of Nine Angles and all the rest of it. So we'll be right back with the War Room in a moment. We are back with the War Room. I am Lara Logan, filling in for the very wonderful, very, very wonderful team here. My guest with me is Becca Spinks, and Becca is a specialist in these online satanic accelerationist cults that are really targeting our children. And for anyone who hears that and thinks, well, that sounds crazy, well, if you don't figure this out and quickly, you're the crazy one, because this is a real threat. So, Becca, I would love to look at the links to mass shootings in the U.S., but before we do that, can you just map out some of the network? I know it's vast and it spans the globe, but there are different factions. Like, you did a really good job of this in your film with, you know, you had on the one hand the Order of Nine Angles, the 764 Network, the maniac murder cult in Ukraine. So explain to the audience how this all looks.
Yeah, so 764 is really just one branch of a broad cyber criminal community that we call COM. It's short for community. I've been explaining this to people as if it's like the dark web, but operating on like Telegram and Discord and other social media and encrypted apps, as opposed to the dark, like on the dark web, right? But every type of criminal activity you can imagine, from hacking to like animal abuse rings, child pornography, all of that stuff is present in this like COM landscape. So 764 emerged in about 2021, and I was actually a 15-year-old named Bradley Cadenhead from Texas who started it.
Yeah.
And for people who ask what 764 stands for all the time, it's really a nothing burger. It's actually just three digits of his zip code. Huh. So it really is meaningless. But these self-harm and extortion cults have been around for quite a long time. It wasn't until, 764 came around that we really saw it start to proliferate and spread online and get much worse. It does have its roots and influence in this satanic cult called the Order of Nine Angles. It's, mm-hmm. it's a cult that started in the UK in the 70s and was really honestly pretty innocuous up until recently in the age of the internet, when they started spreading their influence into these online groups. And so some of the early members of these of 764 and some of the predecessor extortion groups were linked to that cult. And that's how we saw the aesthetic kind of seep in to the broader landscape.
So because now, the Order of Nine Angles is essentially satanic, right?
Yes. It's a satanic accelerationist. We would even call them neo-Nazis, honestly, in their ideology. But the people who are doing these acts now are very far removed from those actual cultists. It's the cultist's job to spread evil. And they do this through seeding propaganda, provoking people, and setting in motion these kind of viral phenomena that will basically have taken a life of their own and started to spread independently of the cult. And so now it's basically just they lit a match and started a giant brush fire. So when we talk about some of the mass shootings that have been influenced by these online communities like 764, the people, like the 15-year-old kids who are going to school and shooting people, are not actually part of the Order of Nine Angles. Even though they might be using their symbology, it's really just more of a like an edgy meme that they're blasting out. Mm. If that makes sense.
To make themselves look cool.
Yeah. And so because people often call them LARPers, right? Like fake, like live action role players, like they're not real cultists. They have come up with a new term for this. It's called LARPer core. And that's kind of them using these crazy aesthetics, writing on their guns, posting the Order of Nine Angles stuff, following all these pages about mass shootings. And it's really just this really insidious, radical, extreme community that they find themselves in online.
And what about the maniac murder cult? How does that fit in?
So maniac murder cult, that's a Ukrainian, it's very, very interesting. I have like a lot of information about it on my Substack, but it's actually a Ukrainian origin, and it was founded by a serial killer kind of guy. And it was basically just a satanic serial killer cult that eventually started to incorporate Order of Nine Angles ideology into their ideology. So the two kind of merged.
Yeah.
And then that, which is it's an Eastern European, so it's a foreign terror organization, right? They have found their way into these online groups and tried to start provoking kids to do things like go commit mass stabbings, mass shootings, assaults on camera. And they try to get them to videotape it in order to like gain access to you know, higher levels of the cult. So that's also something that's happening that hasn't got a lot of attention. It hasn't got as much attention as 764 has.
Did the third assassination attempt on President Trump, the guy that was responsible for that, who didn't get very far, mm-hmm. you know, the one he was, he murdered his parents.
Nikita Kassab, yeah.
Yeah, and then he was going to go to murder President Trump.
Yes.
Was he connected to Maniac Murder Cult?
Yes. He was connected to Order of Nine Angles communities, and he was also connected to some other Eastern European groups. I don't know if it was MKY exactly, but it was definitely connected to like some Russian and Ukrainian neo-Nazi factions that overlapped with the Order of Nine Angles. And it was a mishmash for him, but it was very clear that someone from a foreign country had provoked him and also groomed him, unfortunately convinced him to kill his parents and do all of these things.
And that they were really providing crazy. And then after killing his parents, right, the plan was that he would then go and pick up the weapons and then all the instructions for the assassination.
Yeah, he was going from state to state to state.
Yeah.
On his mission to assassinate Trump, and they were able to stop him.
And this is after Thomas Crooks. This is after the moron from right. from the Ukraine.
It didn't
war,
get
that
as much
idiot.
Attention.
It did not. It got hardly any attention at all. And a lot of people might say, like, what third assassination attempt are you talking about? But that was, I mean, the kid already killed his parents.
Yeah, that was a really big deal. I'm surprised it didn't get more attention than it did, honestly. Well, especially because there's a very clear satanic element to it. So it was very, that one was like very clearly connected to these groups.
And then how do the incels fit in to this?
I'm not sure the incels really fit in necessarily to this particular landscape. I think that what's happened with the incels is you have...
And can you explain to the audience what that means?
Incel is short for involuntarily celibate. So
yeah.
These are young, dejected men who feel spurned by women in society, like there's no hope for them and like they can't find a romantic partner.
They just don't know how to function in the real world.
Yeah,
right?
A lot of them are just kind of non-functional individuals, yes. But
they hide in the digital world.
I think that for the incels, what it is more, they're their own little subculture that doesn't really go out too much and like, relate to all these other groups. However, these bad actors will absolutely infiltrate their communities and try to provoke them to go commit acts of violence.
And recruit from there?
Right. Because, there's nothing more inherently dangerous and violent. I mean, these guys are powder kegs. They're sexually frustrated. They're being blackpilled and told there's no hope for them.
They lack social skills, right? They're not comfortable in their own skin or in the real world.
These are very easy people to groom into going and committing an act of violence. Yeah.
So this is the scary part because, you know, obviously this, the whole, you know, trance shooter thing with the assassination of Charlie Kirk is a big subject right now. And on the one hand, you know, you have real evidence like DNA, the FBI says that's tying this kid, and you have the whole thing with the trans roommate, and this is a very real issue. Mm-hmm. But for me, what I see when I look at that is this has all the hallmarks of a professional operation, and that organizations like the intelligence agencies, they go to these places, to the incel community, to the accelerationist community. That's where they recruit. Right. I mean, these people think they're the handlers because they're recruiting young kids to hurt themselves, but they're being handled themselves.
Well, I mean, you know, I don't really have any like inside information about the assassination of Charlie Kirk. However, it's very clear to me that this person was radicalized in these online communities.
Mm-hmm.
And like you're saying, you know, it's really easy for bad actors to identify the types of people who are vulnerable. Mm. Who could be, either a patsy or a proxy soldier, right? Like a foot soldier.
Exactly.
So they're in their minds, they think that they're doing this like amazing act. That's just like the kid mm-hmm. who went to assassinate Trump. He was being convinced that he was going to be flown to the Ukraine and treated like a king. Obviously, that's not true. Obviously, that was not never going to happen. But these people had convinced him that he was part of a like a multi-pronged terror attack, that there were 10 other people just like him who were going to attack at the same time, and it was going to be part of this huge terror event. And none of that was even true. They had just brainwashed this kid into believing it. They just wound him up like a toy soldier.
You know, in information warfare, that what that reminds me of is in any compartment, right? Because there's different, it's all the different aspects of the operation are compartmentalized. But in any one compartment, what you'll find is an unwit who has mm-hmm. absolutely no idea that they're part of something, right? Then you have a halfwit who has some information, but isn't right on to the whole operation. And then you have full wits. And even your full wit, they may know what's happening in their compartment, but they may not know how they fit into a broader strategic vision. And that's, you know, that's what this reminds me of. You have a kid who knows he's there to kill Charlie Kirk, right? And he thinks he's there to kill Charlie Kirk. But isn't it convenient how he just, how he leaves a trail of evidence, mm-hmm. you know, tying him to the crime? It's like, come on, mm-hmm. you have to be kidding me. It's too easy to stage that with someone who's vulnerable. Like you said, a proxy.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and you know, that's all possible. I guess, you know, definitely, I don't know if we'll ever have that kind of information, unfortunately, you know, but I will also say that I have seen kids being coerced into doing these kinds of things when it seems like really there's no deeper conspiracy. A lot of times these kids just find themselves in these chat rooms where multiple people are spamming them. Go shoot up your school. Do it, do it, do it. And they go and they do it, you know? So I think that there's a lot of nuance. It's not just one thing or the other. Mm-hmm. I think that, like you said, absolutely, it's not far-fetched that an intelligence agency would see these same things that I'm seeing and saying, hey, this is a great group for us to target to go commit a terror attack against the United States.
Because they're vulnerable.
Right, exactly.
And they can be manipulated.
Yes. And they're young and they're vulnerable and they can be manipulated. And that's the same thing that happened with the maniac murder cult leader, whose name was Mikhail Chikikvishvili. And he went by the name Butcher, and he was planning a terror attack by proxy in New York City while he was all the way in Moldova. So they finally arrested him, and they just extradited him last month. He was a major, major catch for the DOJ. Because, you know, these guys are proxy terrorists who are doing all of this from the internet in another country.
So how does this connect to Antifa? Because this is big, big, big news here. I don't know if we have that clip, but President Trump, of course, just announced that he has declared Antifa to be a domestic terrorist organization. And this is something really interesting because, of course, I'm not sure people realize that going back as far as the McCarthy era trials, right, when the U.S. was going after communists, Hollywood has rewritten that history to say there were no communists and it was a dark period of, you know, surveillance and fascism in the United States. But if you actually watch the testimony given by people in the McCarthy era trials on the floor of Congress, they've got the National Lawyers Guild on one side and they've got the ACLU on the other side, and they're all sitting there admitting that they're communists. Mm-hmm. Well, that committee, which was the Committee on Internal Security Threats, was disbanded after the McCarthy era trials, and the subcommittee was disbanded, and then they went after the Smith Act, which was really, you know, which was really our protection against internal security threats. And so now, you know, that really held Trump back in his first term. But now look what he says. I'm pleased to inform our many USA patriots that I'm designating Antifa, a sick, dangerous, radical left disaster, as a major terrorist threat organization. I'll also be strongly recommending that those funding Antifa be thoroughly investigated in accordance with the highest legal standards and practices. Thank you for your attention to this matter. So when you saw that, what did that mean to you? How did that resonate, given what you know about these online networks?
Well, a couple of months ago, maybe it was a couple months ago, I tweeted out something saying that, like, I have been seeing a lot of left-wing extremism, like a rise in far-left violent rhetoric. And I find it very concerning. In fact, you know, I've spent years in these Telegram channels watching neo-Nazis and what they would call, quote, far-right extremists, right? Plotting their terror attacks. And now the tide has shifted and I'm seeing way more far left terrorism. When I tweeted that out, I got attacked by people like, how dare you claim that our side is, you know,
the party of peace.
And I'm like, listen, I'm not even really a very political person. I see the factual evidence in front of me and I report on it. And I warn you that this is the type of terrorism that I'm seeing right now. I'm seeing this grow faster than any other type. So I've seen a lot of transgender radical militant cells that are training and organizing, and they're part of Antifa. And it's very, very concerning. The rhetoric that's coming from them is really, we need to attack and overthrow the United States of America. It's not, we want to make sure that no one ever comes in with a fascist regime. Okay, well, I'm sure we all want that, right?
Right.
But they're saying we want to overthrow the government because it's already fascist, right?
Well, that's
what they're telling themselves.
That's very interesting because, you know, there's sort of three pillars of the legal definition of a domestic terrorist organization. And one of them is that they have to commit violence. Mm-hmm. You know, two is, I think, that they have to have, if I remember this right, they have to actually commit crimes. And three is that they need to be advocating for the overthrow of the United States government. And so, you know, you really do hit all three of those with Antifa. But would you like to see that designation expanded to these other groups?
I think that 764 is already a tier one terror threat. I don't think they've declared it a terror organization, but it is already being treated like terrorism. And then when you get to, you know, other groups, Terrorgram is a really good example of what a far right extremist network that they've recently declared a foreign terror organization.
Terrorgram?
Yeah, Terrorgram, which is this network of Telegram channels where they're basically like neo-Nazis, but they're also accelerationists, right? They want to overthrow the world order and they're promoting mass shootings and terror attacks. This is another big place we saw a lot of mass shootings coming from, especially maybe like 2 to 4 years ago. All of that's very, very scary, and it's definitely terrorism.
How many of these groups use the swastika and other sort of Nazi symbols as a symbol of evil, but, you know, compared to how many of them really adhere to that ideology?
It depends on where you're looking, but for the most part, there's layers, right? On the more superficial layer, like a good example is Solomon Henderson in Antioch High School, which was in Nashville. That was in January. This kid was black. He was just a black kind of incel type of male who went and shot up a school. And he had this whole journal about, you know, it was just like neo-Nazi white supremacy stuff, right? And how he's like a self-hating black person. And none of this is genuine. Obviously, he's not a 15-year-old black neo-Nazi. He's not a national socialist who's like studying, you know, this ideology. He's being groomed and indoctrinated.
And brainwashed.
So a lot of them do use the swastika as just an aesthetic, not just an aesthetic, but to get people riled up and to make people think, oh my God, Nazis. Because what the whole idea is that they know that if they can get a kid to go shoot up a school and have all this stuff written all over his guns, that the media will cherry pick it. And the right will say he was trans or this and that. And the left will say, oh, he was a Nazi. Look at this. And they'll fight each other. So that's the point of why they have all these contradicting ideologies in their manifestos and written on their guns, is because they want that virality. And we give it to them every single time.
See, that's where I see in operational terms the hand, the puppet master that's guiding and pulling the strings, right? Because they're the ones, what do they really want? They want us to be at war with each other.
Yes. Yeah. I mean, a divide and conquer.
Right? Yeah.
Yeah. Obviously we can't be getting along. That wouldn't benefit anybody.
No, that would be most inconvenient, right? And that's why you have to sort of teach people to hate each other. But I don't think it's going to work. Do you?
It's working pretty good right now. Every time that there's a shooting, I will say that in these last couple of shootings, people have started to say, oh my gosh, this is an O9A influence, blah, blah, blah. And this is accelerationism. And I'm seeing the term accelerationism used a lot when all these shootings happen. And in the back of my mind, I'm like, are people finally starting to get it? You know, but this is still a minority of the voices out there, and they're still drowned out by the large left and right organizations. Like, for example, the ADL, with the one in Colorado, this last shooting, the ADL comes in and says he was clearly a neo-Nazi. And the right comes in and says, no, he was, you know, whatever, he had a transgender uncle. And I'm like, you know, you're all just missing the fact that he was driven to this by these online accelerationist, you know, he's an accelerationist. He's not right or left.
Right? And by accelerationist, you mean he's someone who believes that by committing evil, he can accelerate. The more evil that they commit, they can accelerate the decline of humanity.
Or violent terrorist actions, right? They believe that they can destabilize society by causing chaos and causing a division between the right and left and causing fighting, and by maybe getting gun control laws passed or censorship.
Yes.
Right? These kinds of things that get us really riled up. It's a tactic just reminiscent of the strategy of tension in Italy's Years of Lead, where they used the strategy of tension, where they would commit these terror attacks and, you know, frame it this way or that way to get people afraid and to get people disoriented. And that's the goal.
Well, this is a classic Nazi tactic, actually, because it's, you know, funding both sides, creating the problem so that you can be the solution. This is, you know, Joseph Goebbels in 101. It's quite something. Well, you know, one of the things, though, that I just I think is important to point out for parents is that first you have to be aware of it, but how do you protect your children from it? Because as I understand, they pray, you know, they look online for groups, like if there's a group for kids with eating disorders or whatever it happens to be, they know where to find the vulnerable children and give them a home and give them an identity, right?
Yes. Yes. So the one thing that all of these children have in common, whether they're victims or perpetrators, that they all have unmonitored internet access, right? So that's the one thing they have in common. So if your child has an account on Discord or something, you don't even know about it, maybe, they could be in one of these communities right now. In fact, I've had parents watch my videos or go subscribe to my Substack and read my articles and then message me and say, you inspired me to go look at my kids' devices, and I found them in one of these chat rooms where they're spamming gore and stuff. So I've had that happen more than once, more than one parent come to me and say these things. Or I've had them say, you know what, I sent this to all of my friends and my family members who have kids on Roblox because I couldn't believe it.
My children deleted Roblox this
good.
Week.
There's no reason to have Roblox. I mean, it's a town square that you're throwing your kid into where they can just talk to strangers. There's really no reason for your kid to have Roblox at all.
No. Okay. And just before we come up on the break, how the role of the satanic component in all of this?
Are you asking, like, what do you mean about the role of the satanic component?
I mean, what is it? How committed are these groups to Satanism? To me, when I look at all of this, it's godless.
Right, it is,
right?
Absolutely.
It's separating kids from their parents. That's one of the tactics that they use, which is breaking up the family,
right.
Which is, and when you turn to darkness like that, you're turning away from everything that is good.
Right. And well, it is the output of these kind of satanic elements, because when you look at the groups like the Order of Nine Angles and all of their little splinter movements, the goal is to infiltrate and subvert and provoke transgressive acts. And so when they're infiltrating these communities full of radicalized children, right, what they're trying to do is they're trying to get those kids to go do more evil things, abuse other kids or commit terror attacks. And that's their idea of subverting our youth. It's a terror attack on our country using our kids as little terrorist soldiers, right? And so that's why it's so important for parents to be vigilant and keep their kids out of these spaces, because parents really are the barrier to entry here. If we all paid more attention to our kids and we all were aware of this, and if, you know, wouldn't it be awesome if the president tweeted something out about this and said, parents, watch your kids' internet usage,
yes,
because this is happening. You know, think about how many of these things we could potentially prevent just by having that barrier to our kids even accessing these places in the first place.
So it makes me feel, you know, one, I feel like a bad mother. I got a lot of work to do when I get home, but keep your kids close, right? That's the thing. Keep your kids close, because as long as, you know, they tell you about it, we have a rule in my house. As long as, you know, I hear it from you, you're not in trouble, because separating your kids, putting them in this space where they can be exploited by these people, this is a very, very, very real and serious thing.
Yes.
It reminds me very much of Charlie Kirk, because Charlie was all about, you know, faith and family, right? And then his country in that order. And he was right. He was right. So hold your children close, right?
Yes.
Yes, hold your children close. Becca, you're amazing. You really are amazing. I have so much respect and regard for you. I'm so grateful for all the work that you've done, the risk that you've taken. I would urge everybody out there, go to your Substack, go to your X account, watch this film series that you made, read the reports, follow you on X. Where else are you? Are you everywhere?
X and Substack, those are the big ones. I have a lot of resources on my Substack for parents. It's vxrights.substack.com.
Okay, and to all the prayer warriors out there, we hope they'll be praying for you. We're calling up an army of prayer warriors. Well, if you've been watching my interview with Becca Spinks about satanic acceleration cults online, that was pretty heavy. Important things for us to know, difficult things for us to confront, but nevertheless, quite a burden. So let's shift the mood here. I stumbled across this online, and it made me laugh, so I wanted to share it. If we can play the clip, it's a new movement. There's Make America Great Again. There's Make America All Kinds of Thing Again. Well, this is a new one for you.
I got to thinking, there's MAHA, Make America Healthy Again. MAGA, Make America Great Again. But what we really need to do is Make America Follow the Constitution Again. Motherfucker. That sounded better in my head.
I love that woman. I think she says, I really didn't think about that. I really didn't give that enough thought or something like that. And speaking of humor, I had the pleasure of meeting a fabulously funny woman out of Britain. Her name is Katie Hopkins. This woman is just unbelievable. She has been around quite a while now. She was the most hated woman in Britain for a very long time. She was on The Apprentice over in the UK, and then she fired them when she won. And she was also on another reality TV show. She is fabulously funny. You can find her on Batshit Bonkers Britain is this segment that she does every day where it's a satirical segment that really sort of cuts to the bone, exposing a lot of what is going on in the United Kingdom, where apparently they've completely and utterly lost their minds. She's a good friend of Tommy Robinson. I know Alex Jones is a big Tommy Robinson fan, as am I. And she was a friend of Charlie Kirk. So Katie came all the way to Fredericksburg, Texas, to my tiny little studio to do an interview. And we have a couple clips from that to share with you.
Every day you don't swing is a day you win, is something I say often now with others that get pushed to the point that I see that when it comes, because I know it. Because I left my house to go swing because I reached a point as a rational, non-emotional, quite masculine, military, some would say ruthless individual. I left my house to go swing because as a rational mother, I believed the only way I could save my children was for me not to exist anymore. And my husband caught me before. And so we had a different plan then, which so lovely Mark took the children and he took them away and he changed all of their names. All of them have different names. And then he put them somewhere else. I don't own anything anymore. That doesn't matter at all. Who cares? But he took everything and put it all into something else and took them away. And then I never once turned up for any of their schools ever, which actually, when you think about what I just said about Schoolgate Mum,
it's probably a good idea.
It's a blessing.
Yes, God is looking after you.
And then I've never engaged so that they would be free of me. And then I packed and I left to come actually here. One of the reasons I love Americans so much is I owe America so much. And I spent nearly 5 years probably on the road in America, off and on, sometimes going back just to dip in, but to give them a chance to survive me.
I knew that I loved you, but I just didn't know how much. Sorry. Sorry that you went through that.
You know, so when people say cancel culture,
it doesn't
come near, and nor should, nor I also would say no one needs to understand that, because actually I will still always hold dear that if you decide, as you did, to put yourself out there. You decide to climb the fence and you decide to be on that roof and you decide. Yeah. Then you own all of it.
Yeah.
You can't choose, as I haven't had.
Welcome back to The War Room. I am Lara Logan filling in. That was the wonderful Katie Hopkins, who is normally not so serious. That was a serious moment in our interview. She was talking about, you know, what happened to her the day that Rupert Murdoch decided to fire her when she was working for a number of different platforms in the U.S., the UK, the United Kingdom. And she was, you know, a columnist for The Sun, and she was exposing exactly what is happening in the UK today with immigration, the replacement of British culture, and so on. And I think we have one more clip from Katie explaining why she has such a fond place in her heart for Texas.
But so when you came to the US,
yes,
right, what did you do in that moment? How did you survive?
I was so, you know, America will always be my, I think, there's a sort of a true home here, somewhere mm-hmm. that's in my core.
Yes.
Like, and Texas feels very it. Like
it's
that, that whole come and get it thing. Like, oh, well, come on.
Come and take it.
Oh, come and take it. Like, fucking come
but
and,
come and get it. That'll work
just
too.
Just come and have it. Whatever you consider this an all you can eat buffet. Whatever. Get it. Take it. Have it. Fucking end it. I mean, one day, someone, please. God, I'm tired. But no, just rule that. And I'm just like a truck. Like today on Main Street, I'll just go like that because, like, a big truck with a big guy with a big arm.
Cowboy, and, don't forget. Cowboy God, hat, boots.
Men being manly. Whoa.
You should be at the rodeo here.
I love it.
They go down on their knees and they take their hats off and they hold it to their Lord. Chest and they sing the national anthem.
I've seen that. I'd like to be a buckle bunny, but I'm more of a sort of buckle old hare. Yeah, it's a shame. They leap off their horses and they grasp a cow and they rattle it to the ground. I just think, oh, I wish I would be that cow. You know, I'd run. Set me naked, run me across the rodeo, jump off your beast and wrestle me to the floor, cover myself in baby oil and hope for the best. You know, these are the dreams that I have now. This is the land of the free.
I think there will be a number of Texas men
come on.
Who will be lining up from here to Timbuktu.
I will be your rodeo bait. What do they call that thing? I will be that cow runner thing.
The rodeo clown?
No, not the clown, the cow. I want to be the heifer. I will be the rogue heifer. Yeah, or what's the old cow, the knackered old cow that no one dares get rid of because everyone loves it? I'll be her running across the pitch, field, track, whatever.
The absolutely amazingly fabulous and such so funny Katie Hopkins, batshit bonkers Britain is her satirical bit that she does on X and Instagram. You got to check it out. You know, Katie is also was a good friend of Charlie Kirk, and is here in the United States right now to do an event. And Charlie was supposed to be at that event. And so, of course, we talked a lot about Charlie, who was a friend of mine too. And I think, you know, what you're seeing there, she was so attacked for so long because people hadn't had enough yet. But now people have had enough. And they're standing up and they're speaking their minds. And they're not letting people like Katie be alone, right, when they do that. And it's the same thing. I think Charlie's death has been like that for a lot of people. It's woken people up all across the country and across the world. And what has happened in the wake of his death, everybody knows now, all those horrible people that are out there celebrating and doing their videos and making their horrible posts. But one of the other things that's emerged is the fact that a lot of people are now hearing Charlie's teachings. They're hearing things that he said for the first time. It's traveling everywhere. And his voice has risen, actually, far above college campuses and beyond. And so, and there's all kinds of people that are standing up for Charlie. And in doing so, you know, it's not just about him. They're standing up for the truth. So for too long, there is a political faction in this country that has used racism as a weapon. And that's not to say that there isn't, you know, that there isn't racism and that there aren't racial issues that need to be addressed and worked on. But they take something that's a genuine issue and they exploit it for political purposes. And they use this as a term to silence and intimidate, as, you know, everybody in the audience knows, because you've seen this happen over and over and over again. And so now people are standing up. And I want to play a clip here where there is a gentleman setting the record straight on whether or not Charlie Kirk was actually a racist.
Charlie, for the sake of myself, I really do appreciate the ability to debate with you, man.
I want you to think about what I asked you.
Okay, you mind if I have a hat?
Yeah, sure.
Thank you.
Thank you. Great points. I would say that I am with you for the idea of a colorblind society. I think it's a bit of a farce to say that colorblind society is something we should aspire to, but I think it's a farce to think that it doesn't exist, that race doesn't play a factor.
I totally agree.
Okay. Yeah, you're black, but it doesn't matter. Mm-hmm. It's not the most important thing. Instead, it's, are you a good person? How do you act? How do you treat other people? Are you a Christian? Like, what is your worldview? I want to get back to that. Of course, we're still going to see differences, but I want to de-emphasize them to a place where we look at each other as fellow human beings and fellow American citizens. Thank you so much,
absolutely
man.
No,
appreciate
thank
it. Thank you.
Hey, can I get a hat from
absolutely.
My buddy?
Absolutely.
Yeah. I have my buddy.
Thank you, guys.
Thankfully, I was raised away from all that, two loving parents.
And that's the greatest thing that you are, one of the, if not the greatest. And that's my hope for every child, black, white, or Asian, to have two parents. That is a ticket to success. Please continue.
But
here's something I will encourage you to do as a Christian. Okay. Care less about people's shared racial experience and look at them instead of just as their soul, as God made them. We should try to strive towards a blinder race nation, not one that talks about skin color all the time.
I agree 100%.
And I think, where's my brother up here? Where's my man? Look at him. You got to come up here. Come up here. Come up here. Come up here. Get over the gate. Come over the gate. Look at this guy here. Look at this. Yeah. Right to the mic.
You stand for me, we good.
Wait, I only stand up for white. Is that a white man? Can you look at him, please? Look at him. Is that a white man? Is that a white man? You said I only stand up for white men. He's got dreads. Instead of just looking at everything in the past that's wrong and bad through a victim lens, say, you know what?
It's still going on. Okay.
Say, you know what? I'm an American, and I'm going to use my mental energy to say, despite all of that, I get to succeed and flourish and prosper as a black American at the University of Tennessee. You are a living embodiment, Gigi, that you can still succeed as a black individual. Because I look at you not as a black guy, but as a human being made in the image of God, and I want to know what you bring to the table. Are you good at the job?
Charlie Kirk, ladies and gentlemen, still maligned in his death. He wouldn't care about that. It wouldn't bother him one bit, because this is the guy that went onto college campuses and said, if you disagree with me, come stand at the front of the line. He wanted to have those debates and those conversations. And, you know, I watched an astonishing moment on CNN, on one of those horrible shows, with Scott Jennings there when he's under siege. God bless that man. And some awful man who apparently was an ex-boyfriend of Kamala Harris. I don't know what you'd expect. But he said, you know, of course, we're angry. We're all angry. But when you look at how that anger has been expressed, you know, through prayers and through vigils and through memories, people standing up and speaking up. And there was Charlie. He just, that's what he wanted. He wanted people to talk to each other. And so on this CNN segment, you know, this guy says to Scott Jennings in the audience, well, you know, we just have to talk more. And, you know, and Scott Jennings is like, well, that was Charlie was doing. That's what they killed him for. Because he was out there having dialogue. He was out there talking to people. That was his crime. You don't have to like his opinions. You don't have to like what he stood for. But to say that the answer to Charlie's death is dialogue, when in fact, what were you doing? What led to Charlie being assassinated was the fact that he was willing to have dialogue. Okay, I'll let Scott Jennings take it away.
I am angry, and I'm just I am channeling the emotions of millions of conservatives who are angry. They knew Charlie. They loved Charlie. They viewed Charlie as a mainstream conservative Republican voice who talked about issues that millions of Americans believe. He also talked about his faith. And he did it by going to college campuses, which are not normally hospitable to conservatives, and offering his opponents a microphone
to have what we always say.
In support of what? In support of what?
Civil discourse.
Not only that, but support of the First Amendment.
And guess what?
He made sure that people had an opportunity to stand in a room and talk.
He was murdered trying to do what we always say. Why don't we talk to each other? So, yes, there is. It's not even been a week. So you're going to have to give us a little grace on being angry about somebody who did what you always say that we should do. Let's talk.
And he got killed.
So I don't want to spend any time amplifying the voices of people who lack human decency, who want to celebrate Charlie's death and who and want to further drive us apart. I know what Charlie wanted because I talked to him about it a number of times. He wanted people to be united. He wanted us to stand together. He wanted to protect the American family and America as a nation. And so what I want to do is rather remember Charlie as so many people see him now for who he really was. And so we have a moment here. Somebody put a tribute together. They said we lost a legend, and it's true. And it's hard. It's been really hard working through it. I know he's where he's meant to be. I know he fulfilled his life's purpose. I know this was part of God's plan and God's design, that his immaculate design that we don't always understand. But at the same time, it's been hard to pull the pieces back together of a shattered heart. So one of the ways that I can pay tribute to Charlie is to remember him and see him as they don't want us to remember. So we lost a true legend. Here's one person's tribute to Charlie Kirk.
The wealthiest counties in the country all vote for Democrats. You know that, right? 8 out of 10 of the wealthiest counties in the country vote for Democrats. The wealthiest people, absent Elon Musk, are all on the left. Jeff Bezos, George Soros, Mark Benioff,
sorry?
Mark Elon Zuckerberg, on the Laureen Powell Jobs. On the left, yes. The richer you are, the more likely you are to be a Democrat and on the left.
Explain that to me, please.
The numbers speak for itself. The Democrats are the party of the oligarchy. Can you name one tech CEO outside of Elon Musk that is a conservative?
I personally think... Let me think. Peter Thiel?
Yeah, that's one. That's one. Larry Page, Google, on the left, worth $120 billion. Sergey Brin, Google, $130 billion on the left. Laureen Powell Jobs, Mackenzie Bezos, Jeff Bezos.
If they're on the left, what has they done that was, like, quote-unquote... to do the left stuff.
Well, okay, so Larry Page gives money to left-wing NGOs all the time.
Like, if you're on the left, I don't think you will ever be this rich.
Well, they are. You know why? Because the left...
Because they're not.
No,
because they're not.
The left is a scam. The left uses...
How is this?
Let me tell you why. It's a good question, actually. The left uses people like you that think that, oh, we're going to fight the rich. Well, they protect their oligarchy. While you guys have to keep on working hard to never own anything, when we conservatives are the ones that actually want to restore the American middle class and bring jobs back to this country...
How would you restore...
Hold on, let me finish. The left uses people like you every day, and they use people on you by the trans thing, the abortion thing. Keep voting for us, because the fascists are going to take your rights away. When who's funding the left? The richest people. George Soros. You know rich George Soros is?
Who is funding? Dude, I have never seen a leftist organization come to campus spreading their propaganda.
Well, because the whole university is a leftist organization spreading propaganda.
No, it's not. It's liberal. There is a clear-cut difference between a leftist and a liberal.
After this in a good way, because I'll just say Democrat politics, okay?
Okay.
Almost every major, powerful, wealthy person in the country, over $100 billion in net worth, with the exception of one person, Elon Musk, is on the cultural left and gives money to the left. Mark Zuckerberg gave $400 million in the 2020 election to help get Joe Biden reelected through the Center for Technology and Civic Life. Mackenzie Bezos.
That helps his case, obviously. He would donate money to his...
Oh, okay, but hold on. One second. Mackenzie Bezos with $45 billion, major Biden backer. Laureen Powell Jobs with $20 billion. Steve Jobs' widow, one of the most radical left-wingers in the Emerson Collective. Mark Benioff from Salesforce worth $12 billion. One of the most radical left-wing guys that you'll see out there. Omidor, one radical left-wing. It's so important for you on the left. You guys are being scammed and gamed because they talk a good game about building the middle class, but it is not the party of democracy. It's the party of oligarchy. And you can go fact-check me tonight.
Okay.
And you might actually have cognitive dissonance. Type in this. Wealthiest counties in the country. They almost all vote for Joe Biden. Who gives the most political donations to the left? All the wealthy people. Go look up the top billionaires on the Forbes list, the top 100. Only about 10 of them give the Republican, the other 80 give the Democrat, the other 10 don't give at all. It is mind-blowing when you realize the shift in power the last 10 years. Republicans used to be the party of the rich. You know what changed? We nominated a class traitor as our nominee, Donald Trump.
Unbelievable. That's Charlie Kirk at his absolute best. I love how he always spoke at like double speed because he had so much information and he had such clarity and he had to deliver it. And then, you know, the other part about that clip that is such a great tribute to him is his patience, right? He's so patient. I don't know that I could be that patient. And he's dealing with people who you get a real sense of how indoctrinated people are because they don't even know the most basic facts about these things that are driving them, these things that they believe in so fervently that they're so convinced are true. And Charlie had the patience to go out there and talk to everyone and explain it in a way that was so convincing because it was the truth. And, you know, they say the sword, he carried the sword of the spirit, right? And the sword of the spirit, of course, is the truth, and the truth comes from God. And Charlie would have been the first one to say that. Now, switching gears completely, I want to talk about something that is very close to my heart that's not on the radar as much as, you know, I believe it should be, and that is Afghanistan. So President Trump just had this historic visit to the United Kingdom. Interesting to see how they had to, they didn't exactly roll out the red carpet to him. I saw that pointed out online. But nevertheless, he still went and had, a memorable dinner with King Charles and Camilla. And when he was over there, he made a very curious remark, which a lot of people may have missed. But of course, because I spent many years in Afghanistan reporting and it's very close to my heart, and I know it so well, you know, I didn't miss it. And it concerns some of America's actions over there. And so we're going to play for you. Let's hear what President Trump had to say about Bagram Air Base.
They just went through the Afghanistan total disaster for no reason whatsoever. We're going to leave Afghanistan, but we're going to leave it with strength and dignity, and we're going to keep Bagram, the big air base, that one of the biggest air bases in the world. We gave it to him for nothing. And we're trying to get it back, by the way. Okay, that could be a little breaking news. We're trying to get it back because they need things from us. We want that base back. But one of the reasons we want the base is, as you know, it's an hour away from where China makes its nuclear weapons.
It's interesting. All roads apparently lead to China. President Trump, of course, is not wrong about Bagram Air Base. He's also, what he didn't talk about there is all the Chinese who are reported to be at Bagram Air Base in Afghanistan today, many of them working underground, according to, you know, a number of different Afghan intelligence sources that I have spoken to because I've stayed on top of this. Because guess what happened in Afghanistan when we handed the country over, when Joe Biden and his administration handed the country over to a terrorist regime? Well, I'll tell you what happened. It became a terrorist state, and not just training Afghans, young Afghans, to be future terrorists, but training terrorists from all over the world. Afghanistan has become a mecca. And I've heard this from multiple different intelligence groups who are working this problem. I've spoken to people within the administration who are sort of active still in their careers and also retired, and also to Afghan sources in the resistance, many Afghan sources in the resistance and beyond. So what do we have here? Well, the chaotic withdrawal that they're still desperately trying to pin on Trump, even though he wasn't in office, and it falls squarely on Joe Biden and his administration. And for the record, those of you who are saying Trump wanted out, yes, but he didn't want to do this. Trump was going, in fact, those pictures that you saw right there, that's of the bomb that went off at Abbey Gate. Those pictures were filmed by the brother of a very close friend of mine, who was one of the people that we were trying to get out of the country at the time. And all of the family were there at Abbey Gate when that explosion went off. And his brother started filming the chaos and captured the most memorable pictures from that day. And of course, the 13 U.S. Marines, United States Marines, who were killed. You know, one of the reasons, one of the enduring questions that I have about the events of that day when that car bomb went off is why the Biden administration handed over perimeter security to the Taliban, a terrorist regime that literally we had been trying to kill for and had been killing for some 20 years. who had been trying to kill our own soldiers. You really think that the acting interior minister of the time, who was Anas, I believe it was Haqqani, who was head of the Afghan al-Qaeda, that his intentions were pure, right? That's what we're supposed to accept and believe, that somehow this was a tragedy that couldn't have been avoided. It's one of the most despicable acts in the history of the United States and in the history of the United States military. And you know what? For those of us who think, well, you know, that was terrible what happened in Afghanistan, but it's on the Afghans and we couldn't have stayed there forever. There were many options besides pulling out the way the United States did. There were many options besides, for example, grounding the Afghan Air Force because you took out all the maintenance contractors that was provided by the United States. And so the Air Force couldn't function by taking away the heart and soul of Afghan special operations forces, the commandos, whose op tempo many U.S. special operators told me was unlike anything they had ever seen in history. They couldn't even believe that the Afghans could keep operating at that pace and at that level. And what did we do? We built a high mobility force that was in our own image, by the way, that was designed to be inserted to an objective to execute their task and then to be exfilled. Well, how do you do that if you don't have an acting Air Force, if you don't have helicopters and planes that you can keep in the sky to send them in? How do you send soldiers to war without medevac if you strip them of everything, which is what the Biden administration did? And much is made of the fact that, you know, some $80 billion of military equipment was left behind in Afghanistan in the hands of terrorists. But what they don't talk about very much is the human capability that was left behind. The people who were trained by U.S. intelligence services, who were there so that, you know, to protect the U.S. mission and operation, who had access, for example, to the biometric database. And we left all that behind. We left access to the database behind. We left back behind human beings who knew how to operate that equipment. And so what did that do? Well, it enabled a terrorist regime to do what? To change, to go into that database and alter the biometrics of terrorists from all over the world, Chechens and, you know, and Afghans and many others. And we have yet to feel the consequences of that. But you know what the Afghans are still living with every day? Women are banned from public life. They have no identity whatsoever. They've been completely removed and they're being tortured on a daily basis by the Taliban, not to mention that the country is being impoverished and any aid that does still come in there is not going to the people, it's going to the terrorists. And by the way, somebody needs to be looking at what the State Department is doing, because there's an executive order there from President Trump that says that 40-something million dollars that was going every week to finance a terrorist regime was supposed to stop when he took office. Well, has it stopped? That's a very good question. I believe we have our next guest. Well, no, we have a break coming up in just a few moments, and I'll be back with the War Report shortly. To the War Room, I'm Lara Logan, filling in for Harrison and the amazing team here at InfoWars. We have two guests to wrap up the show, so I'm going to go right to it. We were just talking about China and Afghanistan. One of the things that people may not really be aware of today, may not appreciate, is how America's enemies are currently working together, whether it's China or the Venezuelans or the cartels, who are now foreign, you know, terrorist organizations officially. And our next guest, Gaurav Srivastava, is a man who is very familiar how all of this works, because he's a trader in oil, among many other things. He is an American, came here from India when he was very, very young. He's lived here all of his life and has done extraordinary things in the strategic investor side of frontier markets and the oil industry. And Gaurav is very familiar with how America's adversaries are using the oil trade to evade sanctions, but also how closely they're working together. This is some of what President Trump, Donald Trump, is dealing with on a daily basis, in addition to everything happening at home. So, Gaurav, welcome to the War Room. I wonder if you could just give us a sense, how do you regard the threats the United States is facing today?
You know, Laura, thank you for having me on the show. I think we are at, I have never seen this like this. I think we are at a place in America where all our enemies, whether it is Russia or China or Iran or Venezuela, What they have done is they have taken the resources like oil, which we sanction, and we are using, and they're taking that money and laundering it off the market away from the dollar. And their goal is to basically take us away from dollar being the reserve currency of trade for oil, which is what is why it's called the petrodollar. It is, the president is dealing with a crisis where in the back room, it is the first time India did a military exercise in Belarus, which has never happened. And India is one of the biggest buyers of Russian oil. China is one of the biggest buyers of Russian oil. And they have Venezuela right there with them. And they are using that oil to start infiltrating the way and destroying our biggest weapon, which is the dollar. And the president of the United States is up against that. And it is now more than ever that the Western world needs to stand together and protect the currency, which is the dollar, because otherwise nothing will be left anymore.
So, Gaurav, you know, what a lot of people say is, well, you know, the dollar is still super strong. And, you know, although people are starting to trade in, you know, Indian rupees or the Japanese yen, that this is a long way from being a real and significant threat. That's how the Biden administration dealt with it. That's not how President Trump sees it. But I how would you respond to that?
You know, Laura, you got to look at what happened in China. I think what happened in China with the meeting that President Xi had, we had that image of President Xi walking in the middle between the president of Russia and the president of North Korea, Kim Jong-un, in alliance with the largest Muslim country in the world, Indonesia, and its leader Prabowo Subianto, and the Indian leader Narendra Modi, in one shot shows you that this is the creation of a new world order. And yes, the dollar is still the strongest in the world as of now, but with everything going on, and if you it is not far away that if India and China, the two biggest, most populated countries in the world, they get off the dollar market very soon, there will not be it won't be the case anymore. And it's a very, very scary thought. When you put all that together, you start seeing the defense equipment that Russia is buying from, that India is buying from Russia, the deals that are happening between China and India, the attack that happened in Qatar that just happened recently, and Qatar stopping the purchase or threatening to stop the purchase of U.S. defense equipment. All of this, in my opinion, is all interconnected to the same goal, which is to destroy the reserve currency, which is the dollar.
And the attack in Qatar, you're talking about the strike that was reported as being Israel going after the negotiating team of Hamas, who were basically Hamas leaders that were in Qatar. Okay, but
that's right.
I know you probably have a lot of business in Qatar, but I on the battlefield in Afghanistan, I met special units from the military from Qatar who are working side by side with the U.S. But also, you know, Qatar has every bad guy in the world. I mean, whether it's Hamas or the Taliban or Hezbollah or whatever, it is a haven for extremists. And there is, you know, Qatar interferes a lot in the domestic policies of the U.S. It's very insidious with its anti-Israeli component there. And yet it's supposed to be a U.S. ally. And I know that the U.S. uses Qatar as an interlocutor for, you know, basically to talk to the bad guys, and people argue, well, you know, you need Qatar, right? Because you don't want to go and have negotiations with Hamas directly. So you got to have someone to go do it for you. But how do you see the role of Qatar in all of this? Are they good or bad, or both?
I think Qatar has a very unique relationship. It's a treaty partner of the United States. We have our largest military base in the Middle East, which is the Al Udeid Air Base in Doha, in Qatar.
I've been there.
And if you think about it, the UAE, for example, Dubai, more than Qatar, is the money laundering capital of the world. Every arms trade, drug deal, you know, oil smuggling,
human trade,
it's all happening in Dubai. the biggest drug trafficking trades are happening in Dubai. If you read the Dubai newspaper, they almost had $1 billion worth of drugs that their own police caught. So yes, and I think Doha, in a way, they're all, as I said, everyone is ganging up against the United States. A weak United States is like having the head of the kite being constantly bombarded by these negative forces. And I think even the president of UAE, MBZ, was in Russia recently, and he met with President Putin. And if Laura, on your show, we discussed this before. I think in the war in Ukraine, I believe President Putin has already been successful, because when he started, the United States was a superpower, and there was two superpowers in the world. Now we are essentially living in a world where there is India, there is China, there is Russia, there is Indonesia, there is Brazil, there is the UAE, Venezuela. They're all on the table, and they are collectively going up against us. And I think we have to come up with a cohesive national security strategy. We have to come up with a plan that addresses the core fundamental issue that oil is an intelligence tool, and the money that is generated from oil is being used for activities that are actively undermining the interests of the United States. That's how I look at it.
Gov, I'd love to talk to you longer, but we have Andy Ngo waiting in the wings here, who all the way from London, who has been in demand today because we have the domestic terrorist threat of Antifa to discuss. Thank you so much for coming on the show. Thank you for joining us. Oil is an intelligence tool. That's your signature. I know that's one of the things I've learned about from you, and it's true. So we'll be talking to you again. Keep us apprised of what's going on in the global trade, okay, in the global markets.
Thank you, Laura. Thank you for having me. Take care.
Take care. Okay, so our next guest is somebody that I have known for many years now. He is one of the first independent journalists who really helped to carve a path for the others that have come after him. His beat is Antifa. He stumbled across this many years ago when he was on a college campus, and there was a pro-communist rally, and he saw the hammer and sickle, and he didn't understand it because his family were refugees from Vietnam who had fled a murderous Marxist regime, and it made no sense to Andy Ngo, a young immigrant the son of immigrants, who was a proud American. He didn't understand why would people be celebrating this, and that led him on a path to do more than anybody else to expose the true nature of Antifa and this threat. He was warning about this long before anyone was willing to admit it. When Andy Ngo was reporting on the violent tendencies of Antifa and their tactics and who they were as they were trying to hide, you know what was happening in the rest of the media? People like Chris Cuomo and CNN were comparing them to the Allies storming the beaches of Normandy in the Second World War. You know, these brave warriors fighting fascism. And they've tried to kill him several times. They almost succeeded the last time. I'm very glad that they didn't. And I would like to welcome to the program my friend Andy Ngo. Where are you, Andy?
Hi, Laura. Can you hear me?
Yes. I know it's late over there in London and you've had a busy day. You've been very patient. I just want to get right to it, Andy. When you saw President Trump designate Antifa as a terrorist organization, what were your thoughts?
That I hope that the administration means it this time, because in 2020, President Trump did also declare in a public statement that Antifa would be treated as a terrorist organization. And this is during the deadly Antifa riots after George Floyd died. And the attorney general then, I think, really let us down, as well as the State Department.
That was Bill Barr. Yep.
He let us down for sure. No doubt about it. I flew all the way to D.C. to speak to him about it. Andy, I've learned so much about Antifa from you. I know you got your book there behind you, Unmasked, I believe it's called, right? I would urge everybody to buy that and to follow you on X. But why? Why, Andy, is Antifa a terrorist organization? Because, you know, some people will say, well, you're just, you know, you're going after your political opponents. This is fascism and tyranny gone wild. But you, more than anybody, understand the nature of this threat. So can you explain it?
So I'll explain it in this way that maybe more people can quite understand because there's a longer history of it. Think about radical Islam and jihadism in that it is an ideology that can manifest through groups like the Islamic State, through Al-Qaeda, who can carry out terrorist attacks. It can also be those who are the individual who consume propaganda online, have never traveled abroad, never gone to Syria, never met any of these other organization members, and nevertheless take up arms and carry out a terrorist attack in the homeland. So that's the way you have to think of Antifa. It is all of the above. It is organization, it is network, it is cells, it is the individual, it's decentralized. So that makes it actually quite hard to break these networks apart because they exist on deception. You brought up the example, the media deception is actually very, very important to the Antifa apparatus. There are stooges and idiots who think they just hear the word Antifa, it means anti-fascist. Oh, okay, I'll compare them to the heroes of the Second World War. And they do that intentionally to really mislead the public. And we're going to be seeing a lot of that today and moving forward ever since the statement from President Trump. And at the same time, they're also going to say that Antifa is a figment of the imagination of the far right. They've been doing that for nearly a decade. But I can speak, you know, I have injuries and scars that remain on my body from being nearly killed by them on multiple occasions. I'm speaking from the UK because I had to leave the US because of many of these threats. And Lara, if you feel comfortable talking about it, you've seen firsthand what's happened to me after one of the attempts on my life when I reached out to you for help.
Yeah, I did see it firsthand. In fact, we were lucky to get you out. And thanks to, you know, just an ordinary individual, actually a rancher in Texas who helped us send a plane to get you out. And then you know, we couldn't even take you to a hospital. You didn't even feel comfortable enough having records of your medical issues, you know, be public because you didn't want to be targeted again. So getting you treatment at home, you know, from medical professionals. I mean, and you stayed with us recovering for quite some time. My children love you, by the way. But Andy, you know, I wonder, it seems like a distant memory, but what you're talking about when the media was denying that Antifa even existed, remember when people would say it's an organization and they would say it's not, there's no organization, you don't know what you're talking about. And that was because it was networked, like you just described, individuals, cells, all of those things. But you remember when Ralph Nadler, what was that idiotic comment that he made when he was asked about Antifa? I mean, cities are literally burning to the ground and you see Antifa operatives of the Black Bloc because they're all dressed the same and they're still denying that they existed. So can you explain sort of how some of this network warfare that they employ works and what the Black Bloc actually means? That's you when you were the first time you were attacked with the milkshakes, right?
Yes, and they beat me severely on the head and had me suffer bleeding in the brain. I nearly died from that. So soon after this video is recorded, I was taken by ambulance to hospital. So,
and I remember because I reviewed the medical records.
Thank you. There were a lot of cruel people on the left in the media who said that I faked my injuries, and so I produced my medical records. It was very weird. Double victimizing experience. When I think about it, it still feels a little bit surreal that there are such sociopaths who work in the media. The relationship between Antifa and the Democrat Party is special and quite, I would say, misunderstood. A lot of critics on the right think that it's a very close relationship, like, and they look to examples historically, like how the Democrat Party decades ago was quite close formally with the KKK. So they think of it kind of like in that way. Mm. That would be a misreading. It's more so that the relationship is that both benefit one another, but neither one want to exist that the admit that the relationship exists. Because the goals are actually different. The Democrat Party is about wanting to be in power and pursuing their political agenda. Antifa is about anarchy and chaos and the destruction of the state all and the destruction of all the institutions for the purpose of revolution. So ultimately, they would go after and kill Democrats as well. But as of now, Democrats are useful because Democrats will lie on their behalf, Democrat elected officials, and I've seen this in Portland, for example, they'll go out and help fundraise bail support or legal aid for felony violent suspects. Just recently, for example, who have been accused of felony violent crimes at the ICE facility, Antifa insurrection there. So that's the relationship. They don't want to admit, neither side wants to admit that they both benefit from one another, but they do, and they both serve
A
function for one another.
Andy, you know how you can see it? Is that every time that there is an issue that is critical to the Democratic platform, like ICE, you just mentioned ICE, right? So who's out there on the streets? It's Antifa.
That's right. Antifa and open border militants, these whole networks, you know, it's not just Antifa. You have radical trans activists. You know, there's been a lot of focus now. People are kind of waking up. We have a problem with trans radicalization. It's all concentric circles and overlapping interests. They work together. And with the shared enemy, the enemy is people like you and I, people like Charlie Kirk. And so I hope that people listen to sort of the what was not necessarily being stated amongst those who were celebrating the murder of Charlie Kirk. They weren't just celebrating that he was killed. They were celebrating that somebody who thinks like him was killed. And they hoped and they were encouraging for somebody on their side to take up similar action to go against other people. And that some of them are making lists, posting it online, go after this person at Daily Wire next, go after Andy Ngo, go after this person or that. So they feel very emboldened by the murder.
It's strange, though, Andy, because as emboldened as they are, the opposite of what you think they want to achieve is happening. Is, you know, in spite of it all, people are not taking the bait. You haven't seen, you know, and of course people are ready for false flag events because it's too easy now to go out and commit violence and say it's in the name of someone who was upset about Charlie Kirk. But I want you to speak to the black bloc. You know, they were not so visible in the beginning of this. You were documenting this right after Trump was elected in 2016 in Portland when this uprising sort of began. But since then, you know, you see the black bloc all over the place and you see the squads that they have with the umbrellas. Can you give us just a sense of how that sort of, you know, they may not be an organization, but they're very, very organized.
Exactly. Very well put. So the instructions for how to riot, what weapons to bring, what to wear is put out online and where to go and show up. And they do that to really try to cover their tracks. They know that if, for example, there's sort of a central command instructing individual A through Z to come, like that's something that can very easily break up the network through criminal charges of conspiracy. And what they're doing is come with wear all black, wear the black mask, and it serves a very important function in that it signals to the group that you're one of us, and two, it anonymizes you. A lot of them don't necessarily know one another. I mean, the core organizers will recognize each other's voices, and they all have monikers that they use from one another. But other people who show up, you don the uniform, you become one of them. You know, they will hand out weapons, as happened at these riots 5 years ago and still going on now outside the ICE facility, hand out riot shields, projectiles, explosive devices. All of it it's basically now anybody can be a terrorist. That's like how easy it is to join the Antifa militant movement, is that you don't have to go to their meetings and trainings. You can just show up when they put out a flyer online. You don't have to know who's involved at all. And you can help throw a rock at an officer's head or bash a person on the back of the head with a crowbar, and you're helping the particular cause. And also, I want to focus more on like the importance of this declaration from President Trump. I may have sounded a bit pessimistic earlier in that it is, at the end of the day, a statement and symbolic. However, I think the current administration is galvanized after the assassination of Charlie Kirk. It's like, we're not dealing with cancel culture anymore. We're dealing with an assassination culture. It is a serious crisis, right? So the DOJ and the State Department have a lot of work to do. I think for one, immediately what should be done, Marco Rubio, I hope he gets on it, is to declare Antifa an international terrorist organization.
Yes, a global terrorist organization. Foreign terrorist organization, yes. Because they are.
Yes, and you understand very much the legislation that came after in the post 9/11 context is really kind of around the foreign and international element. And that functions. There's international Antifa, they fundraise, they give to American groups, the other way around, they share the propaganda. The State Department under the Biden administration went after a far-right decentralized network and sanctioned individuals and also declared them terrorists. So there's already a precedent. The DOJ right now can start looking at conspiracy charges, RICO. People don't even know that it's a federal crime to communicate a death threat interstate. Like, so there's like so many tools available that aren't being used. And I hope and I believe the administration can be creative to do it, because you can see what they've been able to do to stop the invasion that was going on for so many years of millions of illegal migrants coming in. And they had to become very, very creative with the legislation and looking back on very old laws. So they have to have that same type of resolve right
now. Did you see any link? Were there people coming over the border that have joined the ranks of Antifa?
Not through exploiting the open streams that existed under the Biden administration. It would happen more easily in that they would be coming in from Europe or Canada through flights. In fact, there's an ongoing case right now in the state of Georgia. Dozens of people are accused of domestic terrorism, have been charged, indicted with domestic terrorism in Georgia by the attorney general there. And several of them were Canadian. One was French. So that in that particular case, there was an international element. Of course, the media completely ignored that story. And there are trials upcoming for the dozens.
Okay, last question, Andy. So how do you see this? Is this growing? Is this threat growing?
It's growing, but they're becoming wiser. So I already saw this going back maybe 4 years. They're much more careful about how they're organized. If you look at like Rose City Antifa social media or any of these other Antifa groups that were quite formal in how they organize, they've been quiet for years.